The Augustin Hosinga Show with your host Augustin Hosinga.
Smack the shit out your bitch ass midget girlfriend, nigga.
Welcome back to the Agostino Zynga Show with I, your host, Agostino Zynga, and this is episode number 754. That is siete cinco cuatro with I, your host, Agostino, and I hope you're doing well wherever you may be. This is the Agostino Zynga Show with I, your host, Agostino Zynga. What's going on? What's crackalacking? Great, amazing, good to hear you're doing well, good to hear you're doing well. It's been a while since I last recorded a podcast. I've been busy. Life stuff got in the way, work stuff got in the way, but I'm back on the saddle now. No complaints, no excuses, let's bloody go. For those of you watching via the live stream on YouTube, if you're tuning in, if any donations or super chats or whatever come in, I'm going to read those at the end. I want to turn the Taz show into a bit of a, you know, what's that word called? Into a bit of a free form, non-interruption laden, one breath ramble, right? I do love a little run-on sentence. I do love to go on and on and on and on. I do love the sound of my own voice. So what not better way to kind of create a scenario or an environment where I can bring the best out of that? So no interruptions, no notifications. I'm just going to be rambling. I'll obviously be communicating with some of you in the chat if you're here live. But for the most part, it'll just be me talking at you about the things that I want to talk about. And then, of course, when I switch to the random show, there'll be a bit more interaction and more ha-ha-hee-hees, because obviously with a random show, it's just as good as when I'm communicating with you guys as I'm just talking to myself. So that's how I'm going to do it. But yeah, man, it's been a while. Hope you're all well. Big up those of you in the stream chat right now. Big up Young Old Vibes. Appreciate you. Big up my girl Young Old Vibes. Appreciate you always. Thank you for the kind words. Big up Abe Martinez. Big up 40 FPS. Appreciate you too. Anybody else coming in, much appreciated. Make sure you smash the like button if you do enjoy the show and you like what you see. You see what you like. So what's been happening with me so far? Not really much, to be fair. I haven't really been, like, again, I keep mentioning this all the time on this show, but I haven't been out in ages, like a proper rave. And maybe it's a good thing, because I think I've been uploading way more DJ mixes. So make sure you check me out on soundcloud.com, all one word, soundcloud.com/ handsome black man. So check me out on soundcloud.com/ handsome black man, all one word. You'll be able to find a description to that in my description of the video or description of the podcast later. But I think because I haven't been partying as much, it might be the contributing factor to some of my output in terms of doing DJ mixes. That might be the reason why. Again, maybe causation isn't correlation. Who knows? Or maybe correlation isn't causation. You know what I mean? But I think that might be the reason why. But I would really like a boogie. So I'm looking forward this Sunday. I should be going to Fold. Fold on this Sunday will be a Freddie K, Dandy, and a few other people extravaganza. It was the event I was meant to go on at E1 a few weeks ago, but because E1 got cancelled, because, you know, their owners got found out to be former members or current members of the IDF, people kind of scrapped going to E1. So they're going to hold it at Fold on the Sunday. So that should be pretty good. But apart from that, I've been chilling. I've been working a bunch, trying to get my life in order. Oh, and again, planning my trip to Berlin at the end of the month. So I'm planning to go to Berlin at the end of the month. This time is going to be a bit of a weird one, because I'm DJing on the Saturday. So I'm DJing on like the 30th, which I think is next Saturday. But then I plan to leave on the Sunday morning, which would be a bit hard, but it'll mean I have to kind of prepare and pack the week before, which I never do. I'm not too sure about you guys, but I never, ever, ever pack ahead of time. I always pack on the day, or I pack the night before. I never pack like a week in advance. So if I do plan to go to Berlin at the end of the month, I'm going to have to make sure I pack beforehand. So when I do go and DJ on the 30th and I come back home, I can just, you know, stay up, get changed, go straight to the airport and kind of go from there. But apart from that, it's been pretty decent. I can't lie, this past weekend has been probably one of the best ones, especially considering that Man United beat Liverpool at home 4-3 in the FA Bloody Cup. Most of you have probably watched the game. Most of you have probably heard about the game. Most of you have probably seen some things about the match. 4-3, a really classic FA Cup match. To and fro, loads of great attacking football, loads of horrible defending, and just a lot of passion, you know, on display that made for one of the best kind of FA Cup games in recent history. Now, for me as a United fan, I'm a bit conflicted because I feel like most United fans, I can't speak for myself, but this is the level of performance that we've always expected from this sort of team. I don't think any United fan thinks we're ever going to play like Real Madrid or prime Barcelona or Man City anytime soon, or even Arsenal for that sake. Most of us just want the players to give it their all. Most of us just want the managers, you know, especially Erik ten Hag, to kind of make the common sense picks, to kind of make sure to rotate players, to kind of ensure that the players who are playing know that their position is always, you know, at the risk of being taken by somebody else. But because that hasn't been happening, we've kind of slipped into this lackadaisical phase where things haven't really necessarily been working out for us too much. The football's been pretty terrible. Results haven't been going our way. And we seem to be stagnating in the league. We're not really going anywhere closer to the top four. We're not exactly dropping out of the top 10, but we're kind of in a bit of no man's land. And now the FA Cup is our only real chance of trophy of silverware at the end of the season. So the game itself, I feel like, was extra special because it was against our bitter rivals, and more so because of this whole like annoying fairy tale thing going on with Jurgen Klopp. Jurgen Klopp announced, you know, a few months ago that this will be his last season as Liverpool manager. He's going to take a break and going to enjoy his free time after spending however many years at Liverpool, winning things and obviously taking them back up where they thought they belonged. But throughout the entire process, it's almost been as if like this fairy tale season, it's going to be that. Like, teams are just going to roll over and allow him to have his kind of swan song that will fit perfectly into the documentary. And I feel like Liverpool kind of rocked up to Old Trafford feeling like they could just turn up, maybe get into gear two, gear three, and they could basically dispatch us. But one thing about this United team, whenever they're on the ropes, whenever these players are really under pressure, whenever the manager's job is really on the line, they seem to always pull out the bag. And I don't think it's... Personally, it's going to be a controversial opinion. I don't necessarily think the players do it because they back the manager. I think they do it more so for self-preservation. Because I think a lot of these players know that with all the hires we've had now so far, since Sir Jim has taken over 25% ownership, he's installed a few people at the club already. The former chief executive officer at Man City is there. A few people have been put into place. So I'm under no illusions that most likely there's been already internal meetings that has been had at United. Meetings with the players, meeting with the players' representatives, agents, managers, whatever. I think all the players know that their contracts and their positions, their quote-unquote livelihoods, are on the line this season with United. So they need to finish strong, or most of them will get sold, or will get benched, or won't play again. So I think they all know that. So I think whenever the pressure's on the line, and they really have to pull out a performance, they do so because their job's at risk. So, you know, for the fans, it's a bit annoying because you want that level of performance all the time. But for the players, I guess it's a good way to remind the fans that they do have it in them. They just choose when and not to kind of turn it on. That aside, the game itself, incredible. I feel like, you know, there were so many like good things and bad things. I feel like Scott McTominay was probably one of our better players, even though on the ball, he's still terrible. I still feel like at the end of the season, we have to sell him. We have to move on from Scott McTominay in midfield. I've had enough of him playing there, but he's still a threat going forward as an attacking midfielder. I think having the role where he was able to run into the area, run onto balls, carry the ball across certain yardage and slip plays in was a real advantage to us, especially considering that he got his goal, a little tap in there in the box. He probably should have scored another one as well when he got the ball cut back to him. But, you know, there was moments where he would dwell on the ball, moments where his control wouldn't be there. He wouldn't have good awareness around his shoulders, but still he played pretty decent. Bruno Fernandes, another one as well. Loads of whinging, loads of complaining, loads of kind of just gesturing at the referee. But still he put in a big shift. He played at centre back, I think, at one point towards the end of the game. Antony scored a goal with his right foot. Antony scored a goal with his right foot. Can you believe that? I don't know how the hell that happened, but Antony managed to pivot in the box, scored a goal with his right foot, and I think that brought the game to 2-2. And at the end, the most important goal, has to be Amad Diallo. He clears the ball, well, he blocks the ball from Harvey Elliott inside our own half. The ball kind of falls to then Garnacho, who was, again, super impressive performance. More so just in terms of fitness. His engine is unreal. Garnacho's engine is unreal. His ability to keep running up and down that pitch all day long is really, 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 really underrated. He runs with the ball. And if anything, I have to be honest, Garnacho's pass to Ahmed when he gets closer to the box isn't the greatest. He almost passes the ball behind Ahmed. But then with that horrible pass, or that misplaced pass, I think helps Ahmad because it allows him to kind of step back and do this kind of body shimmy that then makes the defender kind of shake, and that kind of allows him to take the ball out a bit wide and then kind of cut across it and hit it right towards the far corner, which is, to be honest, one of my favorite finishes outside of like side footing a ball into the far corner. I think that's sort of like when you kind of cut across the ball and you try and ping it across the opposite post. It's one of my favorite finishes. And obviously, only one place it could go, and it ends up kind of trickling into the bottom corner, and we end up winning 4-3. Unfortunately for Ahmed Diallo, he won't be playing in the next round because you already had a yellow card and you got sent off for the celebration. But the celebration was worth it. This celebration, taking off his top, you know, and kind of pointing it at the fucking crowd like fucking Messi did all those years ago, was an incredible celebration. A great way to kind of, you know, kind of cap his performance. But again, the Ahmed Diallo thing is another example as to why I feel like overall, regardless of what happens this season, even if we finish the top four, even if we win a trophy, I feel like we have to move on from Erik ten Hag, because I feel like the Ahmed Diallo situation was such an easy situation to rectify or to deal with. Because if you think about it this way, none of our wingers have played well. Antony has had spells where he's been absolutely diabolical to the point where United fans are considering, you know, are questioning whether or not he should be playing for the club at all and are willing to kind of have him sold to a Brazilian club. Garnacho's been kind of up and down. Rashford hasn't really been consistent either when he's been playing out in the wings. So it's not as if like Ahmed Diallo's been being kept out of the team by really amazing performers playing at the top of their game, right? That's not the case. All United fans were asking, rotate him in. He's a good enough option. We've seen what he did at Sunderland alone. We've seen what he can do when he plays for us when he comes on. He's technically gifted enough to play on the wings, to also play through the middle. He looks after the ball well enough where that it would be a net benefit to have him in the midfield, because we have so many players like Bruno Fernandes, like a McTominay, who are quite wasteful on the ball. They kind of need the ball to be in transition, running onto it, one touches. They don't really look after the ball too well. So you'd imagine compensating those players with players that can look after the ball is a net benefit to us. But for whatever reason, Erik ten Hag doesn't believe in rotating. He believes in playing the same 11, if not 13 players, who he kind of, the two he kind of picks on the bench, and that's it. And I feel like the real annoying part about it is that players like Ahmed Diallo should have been given chances to play way sooner than this. And Erik ten Hag's, comments after the fact kind of proved it. He basically said he's been playing really well in training. He deserves more chances. If he deserves more chances, play him. I don't understand why we are in this place now as United, where we have probably one of our weakest squads in recent years, but for some reason, some players are undroppable. For me, it makes no sense. How can you have one of the weakest squads in recent years? We are playing some of the worst football we've ever played, but we have players who never get dropped, players who never get rotated. And I, for one, cannot understand why that is the case. I feel like everybody's position in that club, including the manager, should be at risk. Everybody's position should be up for debate, and if another person comes along who's better, they should be able to play or be able to take over. So the Ahmed Diallo situation, as great as it was to see him play and perform that level and score the winning goal, it was a little bit of an I told you so, and an unfortunate I told you so, because myself included, like, I've always wanted Erik ten Hag to be our coach. I love the stuff that he did at Ajax, especially the stuff that we saw Ajax do in the Champions League. I wasn't naive enough to expect to see a like-for-like translation of the way Ajax play at United, but I did expect to see some semblance of good football, some semblance of good possession play, some semblance of like identifying really good, technically proficient players to kind of play the football you want to play. But so far, that's not been the case. If anything, Erik ten Hag is coming at United and he's abandoned his football principles, and he sort of adapts it to the players that he has, which is the kind of opposite of what good coaches do. All the elite level coaches, or coaches who aspire to be elite level, they all have a way of playing football, and it's their way or the highway, you know, for better or worse. But Erik ten Hag seems to be doing this other thing, which is kind of like, you know, he's adapting to the players. He's also trying to implement his own way. And it's a mishmash of like everything, but not really doing anything at the same time. And then he also has players who just aren't good enough to play for United anyway in the first place. So that obviously isn't helping him. And I don't really buy the injuries thing as well, by the way, because I think everybody has injuries. And when our players do come back, it's not as if we're playing exhilarating football anyway. So let's like put that, you know, to bed. But it's been a really disappointing tenure for Erik ten Hag. But I feel like these performances do prove that these players do have it in them to at least perform to a certain level. Don't get me wrong, the football wasn't the greatest in certain periods, but the performance, the commitment, the desire from the players was what we all expect as fans, and I really do hope going forward that we see this continuing. Now, this won't count for nothing if we then go in and lose our next game, but you know how these players are. I'm just going to enjoy the victory, enjoy the fact that Liverpool fans were absolutely in bits on social media, enjoy the fact that Jurgen Klopp was absolutely losing his head after the flipping game. He was fat shaming reporters, refusing to answer questions. I love it, because Liverpool have to be one of the most annoying clubs in world football, maybe second only to Arsenal in terms of a fan base. I hate them all. I despise them, and any misery, any L's that they can take, even if it's at, you know, even if it results in Erik ten Hag getting a fucking 10-year contract, I don't care. I would much rather see Liverpool fans cry than see us, you know, whatever, in the doldrums. And it doesn't really matter. So, enjoyable win. Fucking love the atmosphere. It was fucking electric at your Old Trafford. Heard people talking about some people fainting when fucking Anthony scored with his right foot. So I was happy to hear all that sort of stuff. And I can't wait for the next round already. More than likely, we won't win the FA Cup because it is a tough competition to win. But still, regardless, seeing how our season's going, I'm happy it happened. I'm happy it happened. Moving on from that, football related, we've got this news courtesy of the Shirt Union. It's regarding the Brazil 1988 football kit reissue that's coming out very soon. So Nike, as per usual, are running out of new ideas, so they'd love to reissue. So now they're reissuing kits, and we've got this iconic kit from World Cup 1998 that Ronaldo made famous back in the day when he took Brazil to the final, but unfortunately had a bit of a France juju moment. It didn't quite work out for him, but the 1998 World Cup did set up the sort of template for him going then on to perform and win the World Cup for Brazil in 2002. But if you remember that era of Nike adverts, that era of Nike football boots, Ronaldo in general, just the force of nature that he was playing up front, you'll know how iconic this shirt is. But there's a part of me that feels like, as great as this football jersey is to wear, this 1998 reissue, it kind of feels a bit NPC-ish, because there's a bunch of girls now, I'm not sure most of you are aware of it, in most metropolitan cities there's this big trend where girls are starting to wear like these Brazil t-shirts. I guess it's like a hot girl baddie thing that to wear a Brazil shirt, and this feels like the male version of it. But I'm assuming you're going to see a lot of kids wearing these shirts with baggy jeans and Timberland boots, which kind of goes against wearing a football jersey, you know, in all manner of senses. But just because of the way it looks and how it kind of drops, it's going to have to get purchased, isn't it? I know it's a bit naff. I know it's a bit cringe. I know it's a bit corny. But just considering what it looks like, considering what it means, considering its symbolism, it's going to have to get copped just for the sake of it. But it does look really cool. You've got the traditional kind of, you know, Brazil top there, yellow and green, number 9 in the front. You've got the Nike swoosh embroidered in the front there with the badge. A minimal kind of design, really, think about it, in terms of, you know, little hints here and there, some different color ribbing, some lineage there. So a bit of a throwback in terms of what kit design used to be looking like back in the day, considering how everything has advanced now. I wonder if it's been made to spec as well, or if it's been updated with the recent developments in material and shit that Nike always have. I'm not too sure, but definitely a cool little kit there. I think it's Nike Dry Fit as well, if I'm not mistaken. The original kit was Nike Dry Fit Technology, but you got the label as well there on the side with the big Nike swoosh and the Nike text there as well. And I think it also has a size label. If I'm not mistaken, these old kits used to have like the big label here and it has a size written there. So it have like M, L, XL, whatever written on there. So this shirt is going to go and do absolute bits and numbers. But again, like I said, it feels a bit NPC-ish. You know, I'm going to see a lot of kids wearing these with big boots, with big Timberlands, baggy jeans and shit. But I will definitely might. I will definitely be picking this up just for the sake of it, because this era of Brazil, Ronaldo back in the day, it's just iconic to, you know, it's just too good to turn down, really. So big up Nike for bringing that back, even though I'm not a big fan of flipping reissues. Talking about reissues, I'm going to be back DJing. It's been a while. I'm going to be back DJing at the Heathcote and Star. It's a pub not too far from where I live, for the night called La Batiste, which I usually used to put on there, happening on the 30th of March. This should be an interesting one because, like I said, I'm planning to go to Berlin on the Sunday. So let's see how that works out. I guess I'm going to have to pack the week before, a couple days before, which I never ever do. So I'm going to have to be one of those losers that packs way in advance before I go to fucking Berlin. But I'm really looking forward to DJing. Again, I wonder if this is a kind of a reward for me actually putting in the work and not going outside and getting on it and doing loads of drugs and drinking and shit. I've been actually working. I've been actually mixing. I've been actually, you know, doing the best I can to kind of get my, you know, my record box library back up to where it needs to be, tagging things, downloading new tunes, mixing at home, uploading on SoundCloud. So I wonder if that momentum that I've been doing and I've been keeping up at home has been somewhat rewarded by this random booking that I don't usually ever get happening for me here at this night called La Batiste. I need to fucking edit this as well because I've made a space there. But yeah, it was fun again to open up Photoshop and do flyers. It was or to design some flyers. It was fun again to upload the flyers onto fucking Resident Advisor. It was fun again to figure out what I'm going to play. I think this time around, I'm going to do what I don't usually do. When I usually go and play these sort of gigs, because they're in pubs where people don't generally care that you're there, and you, if anything, you kind of annoy them with your presence. What I'm going to do is I'm going to just play a set that I would love to hear if I was ever kind of happen to rock into some random pub somewhere in East. I'd love to hear someone play some fucking disco, a bit of house, maybe some pop or something, and kind of end it maybe with some, you know, with some barnstorming fucking party fucking tunes and shit. That's what I'm probably going to go for going into this. So maybe it might start with disco, it might start with some pop, some synth pop, and then end it with some house and kind of go that way, because I did end up going to the Red Lion pub the other day, which is another pub in Leytonstone, which is pretty decent, all intents and purposes. But the DJ was a little bit schizophrenic. He was kind of all over the place, everything from bashment to heavy metal to this. It kind of felt like he was a human jukebox. So I'm not going to play that kind of stuff. I'd rather play stuff that I feel like has a bit more of a theme, has a bit more of a tone, has a bit more of a vibe to it. Again, it would probably mean I'm going to have way more people coming up to me asking me for fucking requests, but I'm going to willingly take that because that's the nature of the beast. So I'm really looking forward to that going forward. So La Batiste happening on Saturday the 30th of March at the Heathcote and Star. You know where to find it. You know where to find all of that nice blood clot ting. Moving on from that one, we've got this stuff regarding Ye and Yes Jules. I'm not really too sure what the situation is regarding all this stuff. I don't really know what she actually did wrong. So if you're not aware, Yes Jules, who is a well-known social media influencer, well-known networker, manager, just a girl about town, hot girl, baddie online, had been working with Ye in recent months and stuff with the rollout of Vultures and shit. And for some reason, if they fell out, things didn't go well. And it went so badly, or I guess it went so badly towards the end, that she got publicly fired. And now Team Yeezy are threatening to sue her for the total of $8 million, it says here, courtesy of this arbitration notice that's been put up on Ye's Instagram. Now, I'm not too sure if this is the working of the guy called Milo. Because from what I've been able to understand reading between the lines, Yes Jules and Milo Yiannopoulos, by the way, if you're wondering, he's unfortunately Yeezy's chief of staff. Him and Yes Jules have been butting heads. I'm not really too sure why. Maybe it's political differences, who knows. But regardless, Milo isn't the biggest fan of Yes Jules and vice versa. So I'm not too sure if this screenshot of this notice of intent to arbitrate before Judicate West, I'm not too sure if this is Milo posting it on Ye's account or if it's something that Ye posted himself. I'm not really too sure what's going on there. But either way, Yes Jules is being sued for $8 million. Now, people are alleging that this has to do with her breaking an NDA. In Yes Jules' defense, she's saying she never signed a contract, she never signed an NDA, so she didn't break anything. But I'm also not really too sure how NDAs work. Does an NDA work in terms of a penalty thing? Like, if you sign an NDA and you keep breaking the NDA, is that like a penalty every time? or is it just a one-hit thing? I always assume it's a one-hit thing. Like, if you're signing an NDA, like, hey, you hang out at Agostino, you cannot discuss what happened here. There'll be a penalty attached to it, but I didn't think the penalty would be like, every time you talk about it, it's a penalty. I'm not too sure it works that way. But regardless, I guess they kind of tallied it up to it equating somewhere between $7 to $8 million. They fell at $8 million, and now we're kind of in this situation where we're not too sure if it's going to happen the way it's going to happen or not. But let's read the article itself to see what was actually said here. So the title of this screenshot on Ye's Instagram account, which was quickly deleted, says notice of intent to arbitrate before Judicate West. It says, Juliana Goddard has repeatedly, intentionally, and grossly violated the terms of her non-disclosure agreement with claimants, including publicly disclosing corporate sales figures, social media strategies, text messages with Ye and management, release plans for the Vultures album, and product designs releases. To say Goddard suffers from a lack of impulse control would be an excuse for her responsibility for behavior that is hurtful, hateful, and destructive. It is to give her pattern of Mendacious. I never heard of that word. What does Mendacious mean? Mendacious. I've never heard of that mean. Not telling the truth, lying. Okay, cool. Mendacious. I've never heard of that term. It is to give her pattern of mendacious, malicious, manipulative outbursts a pass. The composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart said, what? They included a Mozart quote. This has to be a troll, isn't it? Is this a troll? They included a random Mozart quote in this fucking notice to sue her. Huh. The composer Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart said he wrote music as a so piddles. Goddard's own lukewarm and never-ending stream of willful, reckless, and vindictive breaches of agreements she signed and breaking of promises she made left her workplace weaker, poorer, more disorganized, and more dysfunctional than she found it. If the sums claimants seek are extraordinary, it is only because Goddard's determination to disrupt the business functions and sow discord no equal. Fucking hell. Goddard freely acknowledges that she has violated the NDA and intends to do more. Upon termination, she posted on X, fuck an NDA, sue me. I dare Milo or any lawyers. They now do. Her NDA provides liquidated damages, which given the scope of Goddard's deceitful disclosures, she has accumulated a substantial tally from her malicious violations. Additionally, claimants seek injunctions relief primarily to stop Goddard's further violations. The amount in excess, it's not even 8 million, it's in excess of $8 million. Now, first things first, I've only read this notice of intent to arbitrate before Judicate West right now, and it kind of sounds like a troll. I'm not gonna lie. The Mozart thing, it kind of sounds too sassy. It sounds too spicy. It definitely sounds like it was written by a gay guy. Most likely Milo. He sounds like he doesn't like the girl too much, which is what it is. So it doesn't sound legit to me so far. But I do hate the fact that it keeps getting uploaded on Ye's kind of social media platforms. I don't like that he hasn't commented on it himself publicly. He hasn't really kind of distanced himself from this sort of shit. He's kind of let this stuff kind of stuff wrangle. So this must mean there's some truth to it, because if it wasn't true, he would have dismissed it and kind of poured cold water over it, or kind of said, hey, it's been blown out of proportion, blah, 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 blah. He hasn't done so. So most likely there is some truth in the detail. The only issue with it is, I feel like this is a bit blown out of proportion. I feel like if you're working with Yes Jules, you kind of know what she's about, right? If you've been on the internet long enough, you kind of know she's a bit clout chasey, she's a bit fame hungry, she's a bit of a licker, she's a bit of a social climber. But that's what you want her for, because she has a bit of hustle about her, she has a bit of quote-unquote, for lack of a better term, spunk. And all those things that she does, you feel like sometimes, even though she's doing the things that she's doing, mostly to benefit her and her brand, by default, they will also benefit your project that you're kind of trying to do, right? That is part of the reason why you hire AS Jules. Self-starter, hustle-minded, networker, clearly loves the limelight, but also that limelight loving chasing thing is going to benefit you. Now, obviously, when it comes with Ye, I feel like the problem here is that he clearly wants to be the only star in this whole thing, right? Even Ty Dolla $ign, even though he did an album collaborative with him, he's not really been taking up a lot of the limelight. He's just been there kind of with Ye, even an interview he did recently with Big Boy. He's not really doing things on his own solo. He's not really talking that much. So when it comes to Ye and his music and his business, everything kind of revolves around him. So maybe there might have been a bit of a cultural personality clash in that way, because both people, you know, yes, Jules probably thinks in her head she's like the Ye of marketing, and Ye is obviously Ye, right? So there's obviously that kind of clash happening. But I feel like if you hire someone like her, you should know what you're getting yourself into. So it's a little bit of lack of kind of research, foresight when it comes to their team in terms of knowing who they're kind of dealing with. When it comes to her, Jess Jules, I feel like she kind of fucked up because I feel like she tried to do too much. And that isn't a bad thing, because she wants to do a good job, she wants to leave a good impression, she's obviously thinking about the next steps, because when it comes to working with Ye, you can't really think about him long term, because he's only one controversy, he's only one kind of outburst, he's only one random kind of disappearance away from never seeing him again, right? So you can't depend on him for like a long-term career. So you have to think about your moves after the fact, right? So it's perfectly okay to think about that, but I think the way she went about it was a little bit too heavy-handed. The overly, you know, sharing stuff with the groups or with the fan pages was probably a bit too much. Maybe the suggestions or the conversations around maybe fan pages could end up working with Team Yeezy if they proposed certain cool ideas and she took them back type of thing. That kind of guess wasn't necessary. I think Ye has already got this far in his career without needing to sort of like mobilize use his fans in that way. I feel like with Ye, the great thing about him, as we've seen in Rich the Kid, he doesn't really care about whether you're hot, whether you're not, whether you're fucking well, he doesn't really give a fuck about that sort of shit. So I feel like if you're a fan within the Kanye or Ye kind of universe, you don't really need a Yes Jules to get close to him. I feel like if you're doing great work, if you're doing cool shit, eventually it will get in front of him, especially nowadays that he's always on fucking Instagram and shit, sharing things of his story. If he sees something that he likes that he wants to kind of continue on or whatever the conversation, he'll most likely reach out to you. You don't need a Yes Jules to kind of make that introduction or to kind of get you through the door. So maybe some of those kind of, I wouldn't say she promised anything, because I was in a lot of those places. She didn't really promise anything. She was very clear about what the situation was. Here I'm working with Ye. I'm working on this Vultures rollout. We want to, you know, utilize these fans. You're the best fans in the world. You helped this album go number one. Let's kind of further these things forward or push it forward by getting you guys involved in apps and all this sort of shit. Maybe involved in listening parties. All that stuff is amazing. But I just don't think Ye needs to take part in it. Those are things that fans could be doing on their own. But I don't think it requires the insight or the input or even the validation of the artists themselves. And I think Ye has already gone this far without needing it. And if anything, to be entirely honest, he's just too cool for that. He's too cool to be like trying to hashtag things and rile up his fans. That's not the guy he is. So I always felt like that side of Yes Jules was probably a little bit too much, and she probably should have chilled out a little bit. I still feel like the fans maybe, you know, there's a fraction of the fan base that didn't like her anyway because of just her previous moves or just how she carries herself or how she talks or whatever it may be, or how she even presents herself on social media. They just weren't big fans of her, and maybe a lot of them felt like she shouldn't be attached to Ye. I think a lot of people feel the same way about Milo. A lot of people feel the same way about fucking Justin LaBoy. So there's a lot of people within Ye's team, a lot of the fan base aren't really big on, but Ye seems to fucking love them. So it kind of is what it is. But I feel like a lot of that kind of dislike for her as a person has kind of seeped into this situation. But I feel like if you really kind of zoom out and look at it objectively, she didn't really do much wrong. She did her job, really. She did it too enthusiastically. Like, to be punished for like trying really hard at your job is a bit crazy, to be honest, because you tried really hard and you wanted to do a really, really good job and you're desperate to be fucking impressed. I feel like that's a bit much to fucking, you know, fire somebody from. But I do remember in one of the last spaces that she did while she was still hired at Yeezy, she did mention she had some sort of big interview with them. So there is a suggestion that maybe she was already on thin ice. Maybe there was already warnings given or whatever. Maybe. And that's why, you know, the situation happened and she got fired. So it wasn't just one thing. Maybe it was a combination of events that kind of led to her firing or whatever it may be. But in general, sad situation. I feel like it's completely unnecessary. Clearly, there's an issue between her and Milo that needs to be ironed out. I feel like Ye should be a little bit more vocal about what's going on to clear up the situation or to clear up the fucking, you know, issues that's happening there. He's not. He's clearly taking a bit of a hands-off approach on it, leaving his chief of staff in Milo to kind of deal with it, which is a bit unfortunate because all this stuff has been uploaded on his own Instagram account. I also don't like the fact that this stuff gets uploaded and it gets deleted straight away. It's like, bro, like, if you're going to post and delete, just don't post it in the first place. Like, all this post and delete stuff is fucking lame. It's fucking gay. I wish he'd fucking stop doing it. But this is Ye. He's where he is. So you kind of have to go with the goat where you kind of go with. I guess, yes, Jules has to kind of figure this out as well. $8 million. It's fucking crazy. But I still don't think Ye and his team have a leg to stand on, to be honest. If she didn't sign the non-disclosure agreement, if you're punishing her for doing a good job and for trying to kind of, you know, push the album, I don't really see how she's going to get punished for that, really. But stranger things have happened. Stranger things have definitely happened. One other thing I thought that was really hilarious, I saw this on social media and I really didn't want this to be true, but there's also been another girl who posted a similar sort of screenshot and she was kind of bragging at the fact that she left kind of Drake on fucking scene. I'm not going to lie. And it's fucking crazy to see, to be honest. And I've got to be honest, you have to rate those type of girls that are like, hey, I left fucking Drake on scene, because it obviously shows that, you know, she clearly isn't fussed by the level of celebrity, status, fame, whatever it may be, of certain people. But this other lady then posted this screenshot that I feel like is even worse. Because what it does show is that no matter how much money you have, how much fame you have as a man, nothing really kind of prevents you from sounding lame in the DMs. Absolutely nothing. So this is an alleged DM from one and only Drake, right? Drizzy Drake shooting a shot at this young lady. And in the DMs, look at what he writes in the DMs. He shoots his shot at this young girl. Your body is absolutely tea. Can you imagine Drake typing that to some girl on Instagram as a shot? Your body is absolutely tea. Using fucking baddie, gay guy vernacular online to kind of scoop up these 20-something year olds. Like, you're like, Jesus Christ, man, you're one of my favorite rappers, but you're coming across hella corny on the fucking DMs. But to be fair to Drake, I think all men, if their DMs to the opposite sex were leaked, most likely they would all sound this horrible, which is probably why most men should avoid sending DMs to anybody. Just leave people alone like that. Like, it's just not necessary, you know, especially these type of shots. Maybe in person you have a better chance. Maybe leaving a comment on their pictures, maybe liking some stuff and hoping they notice your like, and maybe like some of your stuff back, and you could talk that way. But sending these kind of these cold approach DMs is fucking grim. But it also reminds me of back in the day when me and my friends would go to, like, you know, town centers in certain places to try and bag girls. And it legitimately was one of the worst experiences and one of the best experiences of my life, because there'll be legitimate times where you'd go and walk up to a girl that you want to speak to and she would literally scream, or she would shout, or she would go like, right? And it would legitimately make you feel so fucking bad about yourself. But guess what you would do? You'd dust yourself off again and you'll try again the next day or the very next time. And sometimes all it took is just one little kind of cheeky flirt, one little good experience to make you feel all good about yourself. And sometimes the beauty about these interactions was that some of the girls would just entertain your bullshit because they could clearly see in your face that you'd been struggling that day. You'd had a day of fucking L upon L upon L. So she'd go out of her way to just make you feel good by entertaining your bullshit, giving you a good combo, and in the end, giving you a dud number. And back in those days, we didn't have any money, right? We didn't have any money even to text and shit. So you're taking numbers down, hoping they're legit. And then you go back home, try and text them, and they don't go through. You're like, fuck. And usually it always happened with the nicest interaction, which is, it always kind of softened the blow. It would be the nicest interaction you had, the most pleasurable one, the most kind of, you know, charming one, right? And would usually be the one where the girl said, you know what, I'm not going to give you my real number. So, which is, you know, kind of nice in that regard, because it meant that that girl clearly had no intention of seeing you after the fact, but was nice enough to kind of entertain your shit in that very moment. But I just feel like if you're Drake, if you're at his level of celebrity, if you're at his level of status, you really shouldn't be on IG trying to scoop up random baddies. I don't know. I feel like your time should be best spent enjoying your riches, enjoying your fame, enjoying your family, enjoying your friends, and then whatever happens during that process happens. But being on IG like regular folks, like regular 9-to-5 dudes trying to fucking get the attention of all these IG baddies, I don't think that's the right way to go about things. Personally, I would never ever do such a thing, ever in a million years. Like, I'm very hesitant, you know. I've kind of been lucky that I've been out of the game in a while. So I haven't necessarily been on, you know, I haven't necessarily had the need to be on apps and stuff, but I never use them. I've never ever used dating apps. I've never fucking been on them. So I'm happy that's been something I've never kind of relied on. If anything, I think I'm one of those people who kind of, you know, I think I thrive a lot better in like a face-to-face environment. I feel like I hit different in real life, I think, probably. I don't think I hit the same online. I probably come across like a fucking creep online. So I don't even try to like go down that path. I feel like I can just probably do way better in real life. But honestly, if ever there was a situation where I wasn't fucking married and shit, or I didn't have a wife and family, and I had to go on an app, or I had to go back onto the streets, I would rather go in the streets. I'd rather legitimately try and pull some mums from fucking Weatherspoon then be on IG trying to hit up these baddies. Because can you imagine what her inbox must look like? Just imagine what it must, forget the men, just in terms of just the attention her inbox must get. Because if I'm not mistaken, on an IG story, if you like the IG story and you go back and check your IG story, you'll see people like it, right? You'll see the hearts go up, and then you obviously search, you can obviously look in the stats and see, if I think if you scroll up, right? But obviously, if you send an emoji for someone's IG story, it comes through via a DM. Now, a DM is different than an emoji, right? A DM requires a little bit more investment. It's like you actually saying something, but still, it's an interaction. So can you imagine the amount of interactions this young lady or young ladies of this ilk must have in their DMs, from people sending them emojis, tapping the heart button, sending them actual DMs? It must be absolutely insane. So the last thing I'd want to do is be a part of that nonsense, trying to get this person's attention, because that's essentially what it is. You're all kind of fighting and vying for the person's attention, and she kind of has to choose who she wants to give attention to. I'd much rather not do that. And, you know, maybe there's a hope that she can maybe see your profile one day and like the fucking look of your trainers, or the fact that you drive a particular car. Who knows? That's probably possible. But more than likely, you're going to get fucking air on the road. So there's probably a lot of eligible bachelors and people out there who can offer a lot of things, maybe more than you could, who are probably getting complete air. So for you to expect that you're going to get something out of the situation is absolute lunacy. So I'd much rather not get involved in that sort of stuff, and just try and pull some random fucking stranger at fucking Weatherspoons on a weekend. I swear to God, it sounds horrendous, it sounds horrible, but I honestly think that might be the best option to go for, because, you know, doing this is mad. But to be fair as well, as much as I love Drake, I feel like he's way more, and I have a lot of friends like this, or I don't have a lot of friends, I have maybe two in particular I'm thinking of, who are very much girl obsessed. And I guess I've never been that much women girl obsessed, like in the sense that there are some guys, I'm sure most of you know them, who can never turn it off. They're always on. Doesn't matter if they're in a relationship, no relationship, whatever. If they see a fucking baddie, their fucking heads are fucking turning left and right like a fucking meerkat, right? They're always fucking on. And I just feel like, because I'm never on to that extent, I would never do something like this if I was a Drake. It's not that deep. I'd much rather be traveling somewhere, driving some exotic car through the fucking Swiss Alps, skiing, snorkeling somewhere, living a life. You know what I mean? I wouldn't necessarily be willing to do this, but I think if you're really badly obsessed, or if you're really girl obsessed, women obsessed, this sort of thing is kind of normal. I just would never kind of be in that situation, because I've never really been that kind of guy, which I think is a blessing in itself, because I feel like being women obsessed to this level is its own kind of hell, because it never turns off. You're always on go, you know? You're always kind of wishing and hoping for an interaction and shit. And the mad thing is, time kind of moves on. So this girl here in the picture, she might be, what, early 20s or something? The generation has changed, they get different. So maybe, you know, in real life, she might give it up to Drake, who knows? But really and truly, she's not really that bothered, right? She has enough kind of attention coming her way, maybe enough money to kind of, you know, see out the rest of her life. If she plays her card right, she's probably not that bothered about fame and clout and shit because she's got her own. Because imagine being like a, you know, again, I don't know her name or anything. I think it's her name is there, right? Jazalina? Is it Jazalina? Yeah, Jazalina, right? Or Jazaline. Imagine being this young girl and you're from some random town somewhere in America and you're really attractive. Most likely, you might have what? Minimum on Instagram. Minimum 100,000 followers. Maybe minimum, and that goes beyond you being like a local hero or a hood hottie. That goes outside of your state. That might be even worldwide. So you're known kind of worldwide. You got a bit of a celebrity around you. You get money from Instagram. You get money from sponsors and ads and shit. So you're kind of lit in its own weird way. So it would not be a surprise for a girl like this to be a bit gassed and to almost feel like she doesn't need a Drake. Like, why do I need a Drake for? He's like, what, how old is he, 30-something, I'm 20-something, it's not as if we're going to be in a relationship anytime soon, I don't really want to fuck him like that, I don't really care. Do you know what I mean? It's like, they have options. So, as much as you're Drake and you're in the position that you're in, you also have to understand generation changes, life changes, and he's only getting older, and these young hotties, these young baddies, unfortunately for some of the guys out there that like them, they're only getting younger, and they're also getting way richer. So you're going to meet one that's like 19 who's already made a million. So what can you offer this girl from fucking Ohio that's already made a million from her looks already? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not going to be what you kind of think it's going to be. So when I saw this, it was somewhat comforting because it does prove that all men struggle from the same thing, right? In terms of getting very attractive women to pay attention to them. But it also shows the prison that can be being always on it. Because you're throwing your shot out here to random kind of baddies. They're seeing you and kind of chuckling and not really thinking much of it. Taking a screenshot and they're uploading it onto Twitter and kind of laughing at you. Right? Because that's what she did. Whoa, laughing emoji. Posted the whole entire screenshot on fucking Twitter. Kind of fucking crazy. But big up Champagne Puppy. Big up Jazalina. Big up Jazalina. Moving on from that, Jazalina, and moving on from Champagne Puppy, we have to talk about Phoebe Philo. So Phoebe Philo has dropped a new batch collection of ready-to-wear stuff that she's been putting out recently now for a namesake label. I think this might be collection number 4 or 5. I'm not really too sure what it is. To be fair, she's not doing seasonal collections. It's kind of seasonal, but it's 2 drops a year. Whatever, right? Either way, I just love the fact that she's back in fashion now. Obviously, I've been a big fan of her, you know, since the get-go. Most of you are aware of her because of her fucking, you know, phenomenal run, legendary, you know, tenure over there at Celine. But now she's doing all of her things on her own namesake label. And I feel like the name Phoebe Philo carries so much weight that it's kind of cool to see her making things under her own name. And then also imagining this stuff in people's wardrobes, or imagining people wearing garments with like the name tag with her name on it. Do you know what I mean? It's just like a cool concept to kind of think about itself. And obviously she's kind of changing the way she's kind of doing fashion. No big retailers. It's all direct to consumer. Like most streetwear brands have been doing from the beginning, which is kind of a weird thing in itself. Fashion brands find it very odd. Or it's such a unique and big thing if a designer decides to sell their wares directly on their site. They, you know, fashion brands or fashion companies or broadsheets or press or media make such a big deal out of it, right? Because most companies don't do this. Most fashion brands decide to sell in big retailers, big stores and whatnot. Obviously, Phoebe Philo is doing it all direct and whatever it may be, no big fashion shows or whatever, and everything you just kind of see online. So a lot of the stuff has been selling out. A lot of the stuff has been kind of garnering a lot of attention online, especially stuff like this. Like the scarf pillow, a lot of people have been really kind of, you know, laughing at and kind of scoffing at because of the price. It's a pillow. It's basically a scarf, you know, with a pillow inside it, that's kind of made in this really nice cream ivory kind of silk type of, or satin type of material, and that kind of works like a one of those kind of wraparound kind of pillows you wear around when you're at the airport. There's some really cool shoes, really cool shirts, nice bags, nice belts, nice shoes, accessories, and the styling is amazing. This is one of my favorite pieces, actually. This padded jacket with the gartered waist in black. That jacket is absolutely phenomenal. But a lot of the stuff I really love, a lot of the stuff I really like, really minimal, really simplistic, but again, extremely luxe. This is what you would describe as being quite luxury. You know, we've got some soft ballet flats here for $690. We've got some hand-combed embroidered tailored trousers for $3,500. And we've also got this XL Cabas toffee bag for £5,800. So clearly, the stuff here isn't fucking cheap, right? But loads of people have been loving it. Loads of people have been liking it, myself included. And in a rare happenstance, Phoebe Fowler decided to peek in front of the camera and grace us with her presence with a very, 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 very rare interview, courtesy of New York Times, which I'm going to read through now. Unfortunately for you guys, spoiler alert, she didn't really say too much. And I don't really mind it. I'm a big fan of this interview or this kind of profile because, if anything, Phoebe Philo kind of reminds me of Demna. And I'm going to tell you why when I read this piece. So the headline is Phoebe Philo breaks her silence. Courtesy of Vanessa Friedman. You know, I have my issues with her. I feel like she's a bit of a hater when it comes to streetwear. And sometimes I feel like she sometimes maybe doesn't even like black people. It feels like a little bit of dog whistling when she's like not liking streetwear stuff, but whatever. It is what it is. I'll put that to one side. But she is really a supreme fashion journalist regardless. So she wrote this piece. Let's start with the beginning. The last time Phoebe Philo has been called the Chanel of her generation gave a former interview was a decade ago. The designer whose work offered women respite from the limits of the male gaze has never been all that interested in explaining herself. She said, "I say most of what I feel and most of what is worth me saying through what I make." We were sitting in a white black room that would be her new headquarters in Ladbroke Grove in London. From the hipster East End and the luxury stores of Bond Street, the office still under construction contained not a single personal item, not even a marketing photograph on the wall. Her black nylon bomber, rounded on the shoulders and cropped above the waist, looked sort of like a small turtleneck shell into which she could withdraw and emerge at will. Under the bomber, she wore a grey pinstripe trousers and a matching overshirt. Her brown hair was pulled in a casual ponytail and she wasn't wearing any makeup. She's disinterested in artifacts as she is in oversharing. When Miss Philo speaks, she does so in elliptical phrases, using questions as openings to more questions. Though she became famous for transforming both Chloe and Celine, she walked away from the industry almost 7 years ago and pretty much dropped out of sight, transformed into a myth practically overnight. When she returned late last year under her own name, she did so to sky expectations with a succinct online only offering of her practical pieces for complicated characters who were unapologetical about their idiosyncrasies and inner lives. Quite a lot like the Phoebe herself, as she is generally referred to, even by people who don't know her, in part because her clothes make them think that they know her. It's both her superpower and her curse. So basically she's saying, you motherfuckers don't know me. You think you know me through my clothes. You want to get to know me because of my clothes, but I don't give a fuck about you. Very Demna, very Hedy Slimane, you know, Hedy Slimane, Dior, Saint Laurent kind of era, even Celine era more so in terms of that, which I don't really mind, to be fair. I'm not going to lie. I kind of like that kind of recluse genius who just pumps out the fucking garms, doesn't really say much or offer much to society apart from the making of the clothes. Critics and fashion insiders generally loved it. It almost all sold out in hours and then the complaining began. It was too expensive. The average bag price is around $5,000. The top end of the collection includes coats for $25,000. It wasn't surprising. You couldn't try anything on, and a return policy was impossible. I had the absolute worst customer service, said Alexander Van Hoot, the founder of fashion search engine Tagwalk and a Fila fan, who bought a dress on the day the brand appeared. Now, to be fair to her, to be fair to this, Phoebe Philo has never been an accessible designer. from her time at Chloe, from her time at fucking Celine, she's always been designing for a certain level of woman. A woman that earns a certain amount of money, a certain stature, a certain class of a woman. So for people to suddenly accept or to suddenly expect her to come back into fashion after so many years spent out of it, which you would imagine all those years are spent out of it, she's not been making any money. She's probably been maybe consulting, maybe living off of fucking savings. I don't really know. But to expect someone to come, you know, off of a, what, 7-year hiatus and to now be offering you fast fashion is absolutely insane. So people's expectations were way off when it comes to that regard. Now, the customer service sort of side of things, of course, that needs to be worked on. But most likely, they'll probably end up outsourcing that later on down the line. They probably don't really, you know, give a shit about that. If anything, it probably adds to the overall marketing and the kind of appeal and the buzz that you get such a shitty experience online. Because it probably would echo the experience that you would get if you went to a retail store, which will probably happen soon as well, I think. I think most likely you'll see a retail store from Phoebe Philo very, very soon, like a flagship sort of like, you know, one-stop shop type of thing where mums can meet for like press, like, you know, panel discussions about how to be a modern mum and all this sort of nonsense or whatever. I can see that happening. I can see like a Goop type space, Phoebe Philo, you know, space happening soon. In my personal opinion, but who knows? Anyway, it continues. Which may be why, as the second delivery arrives, the Phoebe Philo brand is really about comes further into focus. Phoebe Philo, the designer, has decided it's time, well, not exactly explain herself, but at least to open up a little bit. So let's see what she has to say. So that scarf pillow thing actually looks really cool on. It doesn't look great on the pictures, I'm not going to lie. Looking at the actual pictures of it on the web store, it doesn't look that amazing. But when you see it actually styled, especially on this young lady here in this fucking piece, it does look pretty cool. It kind of comes up way above your ears. It sort of drapes over your shoulders. It's not like a snood. It kind of fits really, really big. It's almost like a funnel neck type of thing. The only problem is with someone like myself who's black and who sweats and who's very oily, it's probably going to be covered in fucking stains on the inside. But imagine if you're a woman also who wears tons of makeup, you're probably going to have this inside looking like a fucking, you know, LGBTQ flag anyway. So it's probably not for the faint-hearted. But imagine if you're a Phoebe Philo fan, the part of being a Phoebe Philo fan is that you encompass the whole brand. So maybe you don't wear a lot of makeup. You kind of do that whole fresh face, cold water, you know, type of, you know, French chic type of thing going on there. But I think that scarf looks really fucking cool. It's just a shame the price tag. The price tag is legitimately insane. $1,400 is wild. It comes in one color, I'm assuming, right? Oh, it comes in the black as well. Okay. There's a black color too. Okay, it comes in a black color. There's different sizing, allegedly. Small, medium, large, small, medium, and medium, large. And there's also a description here that says like padded pillow scarf in a cream silk satin designed to be worn over the shoulders for a snug fit. But yeah, it looks fucking cool, really. There, it looks really cool there. Anyway, let's continue. Never explain. This is it. I don't feel that there's a huge amount of storytelling that needs to be done, Miss Philo 50 said. The subject was Miss Philo's reluctance to talk about her work and her plans and herself. I'm not particularly into that, she went. I don't feel myself that I need to, that I need a lot of, no, I, sorry, she says, I'm not particularly into that. I don't feel myself that I need a lot of that from other fashion houses. I feel that it's just not necessary. To a certain extent, you either like it or you don't. Someone telling me a story isn't going to make me like it more. It's a coat. It's a pair of trousers. I do appreciate a level of straightforwardness. You know what? I kind of fuck with her with that. I'm not going to lie. And that's primarily one of the reasons why I love Demna. Demna, best era, obviously, being at Vetements. The whole fucking, you know, premise of Vetements is in the fucking name. Vetements. Clothes, right? And the idea behind it was just presenting and putting out great fucking clothes. Season in, season out. A particular aesthetic, a particular type of tone, a particular type of mood, a particular type of attitude, but the clothes were the clothes. There wasn't really much else to be said for it. When Demna decided to get on his whole kind of like taking the piss out of fashion, smarmy, too trying to be too smart for his own good type of thing. That's when the fashion glitterati kind of turned against him, when he's trying to like poke in fun at them and basically doing all these sort of like meta kind of, you know, messaging pieces within these fucking, you know, collections and shit. But by and large, people like myself just love Vetements because of the fucking clothes. The clothes are fucking banging. Myself included, love people like Rick Owens, even though there's a lot of messaging, a lot of ideas, a lot of themes behind the stuff that he does, just because every season he's redefining, he's kind of tightening up his messaging and his kind of output and kind of refining what he's basically doing. And the same thing could even be said for Hedy Slimane. Like Hedy Slimane at fucking Dior, Hedy Slimane at Saint Laurent, Hedy Slimane at fucking Celine. If anything, he's almost designing for the same person. It's almost the same aesthetic, but it's just kind of a continuation, a continuing story of how to perfect the leather jacket, a continuing story of how to perfect this particular suit, you know, style, a continuing story of how to perfect a desert boot, how to perfect a trench coat, all these type of things. And I feel like those conversations, those stories are far more interesting than telling me this story about, you know, some small girl from a small town who crossed this river, then, you know, it's whatever, it's not some nonsense. But it does work for some people. I think that type of storytelling obviously lends itself very well to couture, because there's a lot more of a dream that you have to kind of sell to the people, and whatever it may be. But I think fashion by its very nature should just be about putting out the best clothes you can put out season in, season out, and letting the chips fall wherever they may fall. I think that's what it should be about. I don't really think, if anything, nowadays, especially when you can figure out, you know, how discerning customers are with the amount of kids that are on fucking fashion Twitter and shit, fashion Instagram, you know, breaking down, critiquing collections, people on TikTok and shit, people are really clocked in now. So if you do go out there trying to waffle, trying to spin things, you're going to get found out. So you're better off just making really cool shit and hoping people kind of like it. So I'm into this stuff. I'm not going to lie. I'm into her point of view. I like it. It continues. I never know what to expect, says Miss Philo. I feel like, who knows? I don't jump on the feedback immediately. With anything I do, I tend to naturally build in a little bit of distance, which probably is just self-protection. It's actually been something I think I've been practicing since childhood. Though some experiences, maybe relationships, maybe friendships, I learned can be a good idea to just keep a bit of space between yourself, your inner self, sensitivities, and that stuff. In today's world, maybe it's necessary. She sounds a lot like me. This whole need to kind of compartmentalize, to box things, to distance things, to put things at arm's reach is a great way to deal with things. But I think nowadays, I feel like it's incredibly important, because there's just, I feel like if you're actually doing things, this is why I've kind of always believed Joe Rogan. Joe Rogan's got this kind of adage that he always says, where he comments and says he never reads comments. I actually believe Rogan. There's not a lot of people I believe when they say they don't read comments, but I believe him. I feel like when you are producing podcasts at the level that Rogan is producing them at, if you start reading comments, it's going to negatively affect the work that you do to the point where you probably won't be able to do it anymore. I feel like you kind of need to be in kind of go, go, go mode and just kind of hoping people kind of resonate and like what you have to say and not really listen to all the praise or the fucking booing, so that you can continue just pumping out those pods. Because after a certain time, you know, even I get bored of my own voice, and I'm only 700 episodes in. This guy's like 1,000+ episodes in. So you can only imagine how much he's going to get bored of his voice. But you're only going to get bored of your own voice or noticing those type of things when you start reading comments. So you kind of need to have a bit of distance so that you can kind of create, you can kind of pump out stuff and hopefully have that stuff resonate with people. And I feel like if you're a fashion designer, especially at this type of level, you probably do need to have that bit of distance so that you can create in the first place. Because if you keep listening to the feedback, you're going to start having that play into your decisions of how you do certain things, which I feel like isn't true to your artistic vision or expression. If anything, people are going to come to Phoebe Philo, are going to come to a Ray Kawakubo, a Rick Owens, you know, a JW Anderson, because they want their particular expression. If, like, you don't want their expression plus your submission, plus your feedback, plus your insight, you want their expression unfiltered. So I think the best thing for it would be you create a space where the fans can, because this is the thing that I've always been a big believer in. I feel like fans should be able to say whatever the fuck they want, and the creator should be able to do whatever the fuck they want. But you don't have to interact, if that makes any sense. It doesn't mean you have to think that you're bigger, the fan, the creator has to think that they're bigger than the fan, or the fan has to think like they are the boss of the creator. I feel like they can both exist. I feel like if anything, the work kind of exists independent of both people. If anything, you create, you put the work out there, the fans absorb it or whatever, but you kind of both enjoy or don't enjoy it from a kind of a distance. It's not really something that you kind of done in a weird way. It sort of kind of appears out of thin air kind of thing, right? And I think when you kind of create that sort of distance, I feel like that's the best space to create the best work, personally for me. And I feel like her having this point of view is probably the best, it's probably says a lot of why she come back into fashion. Because I feel like if she had to come back into fashion and play the game, play the media game, go on podcasts, go on live streams, do kind of open studio things, she wouldn't have been able to do this. She would have been like, you know what, fuck this. I'd rather be consulting on the sly. Like, most likely these big designers, I would imagine, when they're on a hiatus or retiring, they probably do a lot of under the cover consultation where they go and work for H&M on the sly without getting credited, and they basically just design a whole collection there without you fucking knowing. That's what I think probably happens, right? And you get probably paid a lot of money to do that sort of stuff. But I feel like if she wasn't able to come back on her terms, she probably would have never come back. So I feel like this way of working is the reason why we have Phoebe Philo back in fashion now. It continues. Miss Philo is famously private. She has never been on X or Instagram or Facebook or TikTok. This I don't believe. She's never been on it. Like, come on. She doesn't have an account, that's fair, but she's never been on those platforms, even just to browse. All right, come on, babe. Though she lives close to her office with her husband, Max Wigram, and their three children, daughter Maya, 19, and two younger sons, her home, she also has one in the country, had never been photographed. So she actually is legitimately quite private, if you think for a fashion designer. Her home has never been photographed. We don't know the name of her two sons. And she doesn't have a presence on social media. I don't even think the Phoebe Philo brand has a social media account, does it? I don't think it does. Let's go back on the website. I don't think the website even has an Instagram. I think it's just a website. There's no fucking legit Instagram page for the actual brand itself, from what I can see on here anyway. Maybe I'm mistaken, but here's the main website with all the fucking clothes on it. Yeah, there's no actual fucking... Yeah, there is none. Madness, isn't it? There's a subscribe button. There's images. There's a shop button. Login, but nothing. And bag, but no actual button here for the social media. So, okay, maybe there's some truth in that. Maybe some truth. But I don't believe she's never been on X, Instagram, or Facebook. Even just a browse. That's ridiculous. She's definitely been on it, but maybe she doesn't have one. Fair. It continues. Though fine-bonded and fragile, she can be immovable when she wants. It's tempting to see her tendencies to lean on jargony words like processing and learnings, and her refusal to engage with usual dance of publicity as deliberately obstructive, except that her close friends say that this is characteristic of how she interacts with the world. I've gotten used to how she communicates, says Bella Freud, the designer who's known Phoebe Philo since she was at Chloe, and who often meets her for long walks in Wormwood Scrubs with the dogs. We rarely talk about fashion, more about thoughts, things to do with confidence, authenticity. It's almost like she's exploring the philosophy. I quite like the abstractness and it not demanding to know what she means. To be fair, if you're Phoebe Philo's friend, you're not going to demand her to speak to you about fashion, is it? The fact that she's your friend, you're just happy she's your friend. So asking her friends about her personality and shit is a bit of a waste of time, because they're all probably lick asses, isn't it? For lack of a better term. Peter Miles, who worked with Miss Philo for 10 years at Celine and helped create the identity of the Phoebe Philo brand, agreed. She's never really wanted to give people what they want. Or rather, she does not want to please, but not in the way that you expect to be pleased. So there has to be something to be said for this. I'm reading this. Why did she agree to do this then? She agreed to do this profile with New York Times, not to really say anything and just remind people she doesn't fuck with you. Why is she probably doing this profile in New York Times then? She wanted to remind us all in full HD, in 4K, that, hey, by the way, I don't fuck with you. I make clothes. You either like it or you don't. If it's too much for you, get your money up. It is what it is. Like, if you don't like it, go buy something on Shein. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's what she's basically doing. When pushed about the groundswell of anticipation and fantasy surrounding her return, Liz Philo stared at the wall. There may have been an expectation that I could have provided everything to everybody immediately. And that's just not possible. It takes time and effort to make things that have meaning. One has to stand for something. Oh, okay, she's being a bit, you know. All right, Miss Phoebe. I love you and stuff, but you need to relax. If anything, I don't think she's ever stood for all women. That's the thing I don't understand. I think maybe people misunderstood or maybe misinterpreted how she was at Celine, because there was this idea at Celine that she was like, you know, pushing the idea of being a working mom, you know, giving birth to kids around the time that she was at Celine and, you know, navigating the fashion industry while trying to be a quote unquote regular mom. I can understand why some women kind of resonated with her with that, because in fashion, the idea of kind of being young or ever young, and being free of kids and shit and being hot and skinny are probably a lot of things that women kind of struggle with. But that vision of a woman that she was kind of designing for was basically her. And that type of woman is still a one percenter, right? Like, very affluent, very well educated, lives in a great house, kids go to great schools, husband has a great job. Like, these aren't regular people. Like, what does Phoebe Philo's husband actually do? Let's see. Phoebe Philo's husband, who is he? Who's Max Wigram? Max Wigram is famously private. We don't know much about his... What does Max Wigram do? Let's see what he does. Max Wigram is what? What does he do? We don't actually know much about him. Okay. Falls back in love with Max Wigram. There's not much about him on here. No idea what he does. He might have a company's house somewhere, but maybe he does some book shit. Maybe just a private dude. We don't know. We don't have a clue. But it's safe to say that he probably doesn't come from a council estate in East London, right? It's probably safe to say that this guy does not come from a council estate in East London like I do. No way, Jose. So if that's the case, I don't know. What people expect her to do? She's expected to come back and make clothes for, like, what? Mums who live on fucking Instagram and social media? Like, probably not, right? Probably mums who, like, you know, go to private members clubs, or who go to lunch at Chiltern Firehouse and go have walks in Wormwood scrubs with their fucking designer dogs and their big designer prams and their nice big coats and shit. Like, this is a whole different world. So I don't know. Maybe I'm confused. Let's continue here. This is a really great picture there. Wow, look at that bag. Amazing. The new bean bag in calf leather. What does Philo Fabo stand for? This is how Philo describes her own work, which involves loose jeans that unzip to the rear of the back, caveman trousers, and coats covered in shaggy embroidery and high collar, almost military trenches, and a pillowy scarf that looks like a cross between a giant padded donut and a neck brace. It's very intuitive, she says, a response to what I see around me, how I see the women dressing, and how I feel myself, my relationship with clothes. She is not, she said, one of those designers who tries everything on. But she does think, can I imagine wearing it? Will it be comfortable? How does it feel? She doesn't try things on. She doesn't even check Instagram. Like, this woman's weird, isn't it? Imagine designing clothes and not trying them on. So what? You just, like, look at them on a fit model and that's it. Huh. Ruthie Rogers, a chief and co-founder of River Cafe in London, who has... of course she goes to the River Cafe. Of course Phoebe Philo goes to River Cafe. This makes a lot of sense. Who's known Philo for decades, is one of the women who wears it. She said that once she discovered Phoebe Philo Celine, basically that's all I wore. And now she's a Phoebe Philo customer. She bought pieces from the first collection because she said they were clothes for a woman who doesn't want to be sexualized, but they don't deny her sexuality. Of course. So imagine a woman that would dine at the River Cafe at lunchtime on her own, reading a book. Yes. That's the kind of person who'd be into this sort of stuff. But big up Phoebe Philo. That bomber jacket in the interview looks fucking sick, to be fair. I actually would like to... I'm not sure if that's out yet, but that bomber jacket is amazing. It's got this really elongated, exaggerated collar. It's almost Sakai style with the collar. Really exaggerated collar. Short, boxy design, according to the interviewer. Over like a blazer and some trousers. She looks really great. She's got great personal style herself, to be fair. Sandra Hüller, the actress... from Anatomy of Fall, is the only recognizable face in the brand new imagery, which also features a close-up of a bare belly with the pregnancy stretch marks and fleshy rolls and some shimmy feet and cut off in the knees so you can see the dancing of a leather fringe mules. Miss Fowler views her work as one continuous collection and does not believe in seasons, which is why she prefers the word edit and divides the edits into deliveries. Delivery 1 of edit 2 is on sale now and delivery 2 is planned to arrive at the end of March. When the terminology was first introduced, along with the statement that the brand intentionally made less than anticipated demand, it was widely interpreted as a strategy to calculate to drum up extreme FOMO, which it is. I wish they'd just be honest and say it is. Please, you don't intentionally make less things because you just want to make less things. You do it because you want to fucking drum up interest and you want to create scarcity and you want there to be an anticipation for the stuff to drop and blah blah blah. That's perfectly fine, but let's not lie and say, oh, because of certain manufacturing techniques. And it's just like, come on, bro, come on. Miss Filer said that it was actually not the aim. Of course she said that. The point was to create a baseline data to help her figure out how much she would need to produce to satisfy a market without ending up with lots of liquidity. Okay, maybe there is both parts are true. Maybe it was done. They created less quantities to drum up interest, but also to make sure they didn't have a lot of dead stock left that they had to kind of burn or throw in the ocean and have a turtle choke on it. To encourage customers to build a coherent wardrobe slowly over time, that's why customers were asked to sign up via email to be alerted about deliveries. I don't know why there was such a big, I don't know why there has to be such a beginning and an end of our industry. I don't know why it can't just be continuous. Agree. But to be fair, it can't be continuous because most people can't afford to be continuous. They have to come really hard, which is kind of weird to say, pause, but they have to come super hard in the beginning. And then hope they can just ride that wave. They don't really have the opportunity or the chance that she has because of the goodwill she's, you know, built over the years, because of her undeniable talent, because of the investment with LVMH, all this malarkey. You can take more chances. You can kind of do stuff in a unique way because you're kind of a bit of a unique talent in that regard. There are certain people in the industry who can kind of call their own, you know, who can make their own demands as it may be. But most people probably can't. It continues. Miss Fowler knows that she has to move product. She's not naive. And in any case, she and her husband are the majority owners of the business. So it's her money on the line. LVMH, a luxury group, was her employer. Celine has a minority stake. So her and her husband have put all their money's savings into it, plus the investment to LVMH to make this fucking work. So I guess the husband must be like the business guy. He must be her gorum. Hopefully they don't break up and he doesn't end up making his own brand. That'd be hilarious. But I guess if Phoebe follows Demna, Max Wigram is Gorum. It continues. I still don't believe it needs to be like that. I continue to wear clothes today that I've had for 20 years. One of my favorite pairs of trousers is a pair of Chloe trousers I made. They're important to me, these pieces. I don't want to get rid of them. So what we have now is a body of work over a year and it's all connected. Her children support her work, she says, but they're not fans of it at all. My daughter has a couple of pieces. She's really sweet. Sometimes she'll say, oh, mom, can I get that? But they don't mention it that much. Their algorithm isn't vibing with me. Fucking love that. The algorithm isn't vibing with me. Good great picture of her there leaving at the end of a show for Celine. Doing it her way. When Miss Fowler left fashion, there was a general sense of mourning and tendency to see it as an indictment of the system, the amorphous force that abuses creativity in the name of commerce. After all, she was the first designer to take maternity. What? I didn't know that. She was the first designer ever to take maternity leave. That's fucking crazy. You know, the fashion industry is fucking insane. No wonder designers are leaving their posts left and right. No wonder people get fired so quickly. This industry doesn't even, right? The fashion industry is basically built on women. It's built by women. It's built for women. And they don't even do best. They don't even do right by the women who basically are the lifeblood, the fucking, you know, the foundation of the fucking industry. They don't even let them go on fucking maternity leave. God damn. She was the first designer to ever take maternity leave when she was at Chloe and at Celine. She used to muse backstage about the joys of disappearing into the country. She seemed to need fashion less than fashion needed her. Celine was wonderful, she said. It was an incredibly important experience in my life, but she wanted to live an examined life, and she didn't think that she could figure out what that might mean when she was committed to something else. The first year away, she was in the middle of moving, so she focused on that and hanging out with her family and fielding headhunter calls. She won't name what's brand. She considered activism, non-profits. I've always told my children, the more you mess about, the more you find out, she said, using the future term than mess. Oh, okay. So I guess fuck about, find out. I love this. I love this about her. You know, fuck about, find out. Quite frankly, I realized that work was something I needed. And I think I had a sense it was actually going to be within fashion. Even if she knew she didn't want to go back to what she had done. In most big houses, designer jobs end at the runway. They don't oversee ad campaigns or the merchandising or the store design. Miss Philo wanted to have fingers in all of that, even if independence and startup meant not flying first class or having drivers or lots of orchids in the office. Okay, so it sounds like they're trying to position this as this Phoebe Philo brand is like a small startup, right? I like what they're doing here. They're trying to make it seem like she's making this stuff all out of her own fucking living room, which is hilarious, when she's really got all the infrastructure, all the manufacturing, all the partners necessary, in LVMH especially, to basically trot out like high-level fashion shit, right? At that kind of level, especially taking so many years out. So the fact that they're trying to make it seem like she's fucking sewing this shit herself in a living room is fucking hilarious. Fundamentally, but you know, fashion, we love these stories. We love these fucking myths. We love to lionize people, and this is one of them. Fundamentally, that is not the stuff that makes me happy, Miss Farrow said. The stuff that makes her happy involves baking, galleries, riding, clubbing. She goes clubbing. Phoebe Philo's in a club. Shit. If I see Phoebe Philo at fucking Inferno, or I see her Fold, or I see her fucking Unfold, or Hotbox, yeah, or Hole, like, what? Really? Phoebe Philo's in the clubs? Sick. Her family and friends, she said she's constantly walking the tightrope between ensuring downtime and discovering inspiration. Once she knows she can trust you, there are no barriers, Miss Rogers says. After Miss Rogers' husband, the architect Richard Rogers, fell during a trip in Mexico and was hospital for months, Miss Philo came over for breakfast one day wearing a big tweed coat Miss Rogers admired. She took it off and gave it to me, Miss Rogers said, and refused to take it back. It kept me safe and warm since. Oh, that's fucking beautiful. Edward Innerford, the former editor of British Vogue, who's been a friend of Miss Philo since they were kids in West London, said he used to bug her endlessly about when she would make menswear. I've always expected I would buy one of women's coats and get it tailored, he said. Yeah, especially Edward Innerford. He needs, you know, he's a big boy. He's a big boy. He's a big boy, that one. Then just before the Fashion Awards in London last year, she presented him with a grey double-breasted suit just because she wanted me to feel good about myself. I always wear black. I had never worn grey in my life, but I trusted her. It was very liberating. Oh, so that's a Phoebe Philo designed men's suit. Fair play. With a pair of Sambas on. Bit cringe, but you know, big up Edward. Miss Philo knows that the usual designer trajectory is a start of bare bone brand. Show that you can do the get. So Miss Philo knows that the usual designer trajectory is to start a bare bones brand, show that you can do, and then get a golden ring to a big job with a fat contract. But she said doing it the other way around was the answer to her questions. Oh, I love this. It's kind of like my idea of when I wanted to start a fashion brand. I was thinking of doing a diffusion line first and then head, you know, ringing it up into the main line. That'll kind of be the way I kind of wanted to do it. Like, start with accessories and then go into ready to wear. How can I do my best work? What is my potential? How can I have the most responsive relationship with the world and where we're living in today? She won't articulate it exactly, but she's effectively trying to retrain people in how to shop and how to think about what they buy. She's a pioneer, says Mr. Innerford, and pioneers always take the heat. Okay, there's a little bit too much going on here about her. Let's relax, you know what I mean? She's got her own store, she's saying stuff direct to consumer, but it's not as if she's fucking designing microchips and stuff. You need to relax. My learning curve has never been greater, says Miss Philo. I think people imagined that somehow we'd been quietly building a huge organization, but I maybe have 2 members of staff. Okay, that's pretty cool. I like that. She's kind of made, to be fair, I like that she's basically proving you can run a company like this without having an bloated staff members, massive offices designed by world famous architects, interior designers. It isn't necessary. you can obviously run, especially if you've got LVMH. That's the one thing people are forgetting. The LVMH partnership makes it easy because they can do all the actual grunt work while you have to kind of just focus on the quote unquote design and the fun stuff. You would imagine, or the brand facing stuff, right? They can focus on nuts and bolts shit that probably a lot of people don't really think about, procurement, all that sort of shit. It continues. I think people imagine that somehow we'd have been quietly building a huge organization, but I had maybe two members of staff and I'm involved in renting space, buying office furniture. She currently has about 100 employees. Okay, she made it seem like she had, what? So she's, okay. I guess 100 employees also includes LVMH, but I love how they say two members of staff and then she says 100 employees. Okay, cool. Mr. Miles was one of the people who she contacted earlier on when she was forming the idea of what her brand might be. They talked about it. He said for maybe 2 years about the meta issues of what means to translate your name from something personal to something corporate, from something of your own to something everyone can own. I toyed with the idea of made up names. Some words are satisfying to say. Some of them are really rude as well. There was really good swear words. So I guess you wanted to make some separation between keeping Phoebe Philo the person and the brand, or and the brand personal to her. But then at some point, you have to kind of cash in on that cachet and use that brand name recognition as part of the fucking marketing or as part of the drive to kind of roll out your brand and hope people that trusted you at Celine, at Chloe, will now trust you with your own namesake brand. So I get that. I kind of like that she went with her own name brand because I feel like having a jacket with her label, with her name on it, on the inside, is probably one of the hardest things ever. And obviously, the picture of there sitting on the table wearing that amazing bomber jacket. But in the end, Ms. Philo says there was something straightforward about using my own name. For all the talk about paying attention to the outside noise around the business, Ms. Philo knows some things have to change. They are working on smoothing out the returns policy, offering more ways to pay and altering subscribers when a piece they like is back in stock. As the collection gets fuller, there will be greater range of prices with some jersey pieces that are relatively more affordable. The intention really is that the pieces stick around for a while. They have to be made well and they have to be considered, and that tends to come at a certain price point. During COVID, which coincided with her planning and shopping habits had changed in a way that she was working to advantage because she meant that she could start without a store, but she doesn't intend to keep it that way. Oh, great. I'd love to hear this. I'm really curious to see what a Phoebe Philo store looks like. Like I said, I've got a vision of it being like a goop type headquarters where there could be loads of wellness, health sort of shit going on for like young mums or young professional women in general. It would be a great way to kind of propagate that sort of propaganda in general. I feel like that would work really well. It continues, by summer she hopes to open some store of physical space, maybe temporary, maybe not, first in New York, then London. Why New York? Wonder why New York first. There may be even a show in time, but right now, she said, in today's world, there's so much fashion, so much big fashion. I try to remember that most of the big houses started with one human being who had an idea about what they wanted to do. Exactly. I love that line at the end, though, because that's something I remember Steve Jobs saying, which is one of my favorite inspiring motivational quotes. Like, you know, most big ideas out there start off with one person just having the idea, and these people are no smarter or better than you or I. So if they can do it, you can do it also. So I love the fact that she's kind of had that kind of thinking going forward. So great to see. She's in it for the long term. I think some of the lionization in the article is a little bit much, to be fair. But again, it's Phoebe Philo. She's a big deal. And everybody's been excited to have her back in fashion. So it's no surprise people kind of really kind of sucking her off. But really interesting article. She probably didn't say too much, to be completely fair, but it's Phoebe Philo Tings. And of course, I'll put the link in the description for those of you that want to check it out, and obviously in the stream chat for those of you who want to see it yourself, and you can read the article in full if you may please. Moving on, we've got some news courtesy of Hype Never Dies regarding a Fragment and Nike Phoenix Waffle first look. So this is courtesy of Hype Never Dies Twitter page. It features an early look at a Fragment, the company headed by none other than Hiroshi Fujiwara, one of my idols in streetwear and in branding and design and in fashion overall. If there's one person I could kind of build or kind of, you know, mold my career after and kind of try to emulate and surpass, it'll definitely be Hiroshi Fujiwara, for his ability to kind of create under his own namesake label, to do collaborations with loads of different brands, to consult, to be the cool guy around town, to kind of offer his cultural criticism and critique and stuff, like on blogs and whatever else he does in terms of magazines and shit, and just be an all-around OG level-headed chill good dude who also dabbles in music, right? He makes his own music and shit, he plays the guitar, he snowboards, just an all-around, I would say, quintessential Renaissance man. And he does this collaboration with Nike on a pair of Nike Phoenix waffles, which, to be fair, I've never really heard of. I'm not going to lie. I've obviously heard of the Nike waffle. I think most of you have heard of that, but I've never really heard of this Phoenix waffle. So I had to go online and double check it. And courtesy of Hypebeast article from last year, it says the Nike Phoenix waffle is available in two colorways. Allegedly, this is a women's only model. When it first originally come out, essentially you've got like, what you describe it, you've got like a regular Nike, I guess on the upper you've kind of got like a Nike Epic. It kind of feels like a Nike Epic. Not sure if you guys remember that shoe, Nike Epic Runner. It's from back in the day. It kind of reminds you of a Nike Epic, kind of, slightly, a little bit, right? It kind of reminds you of a Nike Epic like silhouette on the top, but obviously more of a vintage kind of style on the upper. And you've got this really massive chunky waffle exaggerated kind of outsole and midsole there going on, kind of similar to what you'd find maybe with those Sakai collabs. So originally this model was a women's only shape, but I guess now with this Hiroji Fujiwara collaboration, this is going to be a shape that's going to be unisex, which is quite cool. So you see here on the upper, you've got this nice white and blue design. You've got suede accents here on the heel tab, on the mud guard, the back here. On the heel tab, you've got this nice tumbled leather effect that's got this kind of nice leather bit hanging off of it in this nice sky blue. You've got the addition of a kind of a mesh color here on the body with some more kind of suede accents here on the top and a nice kind of white crystal white laces. And on the outsole, you've got it all in white and you've got this nice embossed fragment logo here on the side, which is taking over from the Thunderbolts. I think Hiroshi is kind of transitioning away from the two Thunderbolts and doing this whole like FRGMT thing going on, abbreviation of fragment, embossy on the heel, which I'm not really too fond of. I kind of like the iconic double funders, I'm not going to lie. I think that is one of the most iconic logos in streetwear, really. I still remember the times when I was in fucking Foot Patrol back in the day, big up Foot Patrol, big up Wes, and some guy came into Foot Patrol and he had a fragment logo, obviously Asian dude, had a fragment logo on his fucking calf. On his calf, he had the fucking fragment logo there. So I really do love those type of things. I think that logo is fucking awesome, but I guess he's kind of changing it going forward. But this is a new shoe, Fragment Nike Phoenix Waffle. No idea on release date. This is something Hiroshi Fujiwara put out here, I guess on his social media probably, just as a kind of leak to kind of show people. I do love the fact that he does do this sort of stuff where he could easily go and do like a Jordan or a Nike Air Max and absolutely crush it. But I like the fact that he would go back into the archives and he'll pluck a model that released sometime in, what, 2003, July, a model that was specifically a women's model, and then he'll basically try and flip it and make it hot again. I love that. I love that risk that he takes with that. Similar to what Supreme do. Supreme don't pick the easy Snikes to collaborate with. They always pick the stuff that's like not so hype and then they try to do something with it. So I love all that approach. No idea on release date so far, but I'm assuming they're probably going to come in three different colorways as per usual with Hiroshi. All white one, a black one, and a kind of colorful one. But we'll have to wait and see when those drop. Have to wait and see when those eventually end up dropping. Next on the list, we have some unfortunate news courtesy of Don C. So I'm sure most of you guys know who Don C was. Don C's role when he was with Kanye was just like a friend, I guess. He also had a role in organizing some of the collaborations and being kind of the go-to guy, maybe being the kind of manager, special collaborations, I'm not really sure. Then obviously he went on to launch his own brand, but with the snapbacks with the fucking nice leather strap on them and the leather or exotic kind of brims on the front, and just generally being an all-round cool guy. Well, it seems like unfortunately him and his wife have split up. I guess they've gone for a divorce. So Don C and his wife aren't together anymore. And the reason why I say that is because he's been posting on his Instagram that he's been getting rid of a lot of stuff. So on his Instagram, he posted a video recently where he said he's getting kicked out of his studio, or he's going to, you know, down. I think he recently posted something about he was selling a lot of his old things. So he's been around since the early days of streetwear and sneaker collecting, early 2000s. So you can only imagine what he's kind of, you know, what his archive, what his fucking warehouse of stuff must look like, especially over the years, especially considering he's in the collections he has with Nike and Jordan Brand and shit. But it seems like, maybe part of the divorce, maybe part of the separation is that he has to sell some of that shit. Maybe he has to get rid of the spaces. I don't really, not too sure. But the video itself is kind of sad, I'm not going to lie. He posted the video on his Instagram, and I think the site called Hype Never Dies posted the actual clip itself of him talking about what is happening with his studio space and whatnot, and if people want to pick up some shit from the stuff that he does now. So I'm going to play it for you now.
Today is moving day. Well, not really moving day, getting kicked out my office day. So, man, y'all see, man, I'm getting kicked out my office today. So, if anybody got anything they want from this, but not begging, niggas begging will be ignored. But anybody wanna buy art that I'm about to put in storage, and it's going to be in storage for the next 20 years. If I don't, I just want y'all to see. Anything y'all see, y'all want to cop, hit me.
So most likely, I just thought about it now. I would imagine maybe if you're going through some sort of separation with your partner, and maybe they're both involved in the creative industries, there's a possibility that she probably just wants a space. Maybe that's part of the separation agreements, right? When they kind of, you know, divvy up things. So maybe she wants to take it up and do her own thing in there, so he has to kind of clear it of his shit. But it is kind of sad. I don't really know much about them as a couple. I do remember he always would post his wife on social media. They kind of have a cute family. They dress kind of alike. They always went to fashion weeks together and shit. So it kind of did come out of the blue that they're not together anymore. But yeah, he's, I guess, selling all his shit now and kind of downsizing and doing that whole stuff while he goes through separation. I guess the crazy thing about this sort of lifestyle is that at the time when you got all this stuff, it seems amazing. But when you go through actual real life situations where your partner decides to file for divorce, or your relationship gets to a point where you can't mend it and you have to kind of go your separate ways, suddenly all the sneakers, all the clothes suddenly don't matter anymore. They suddenly don't really hold any relevance. You suddenly don't care anymore, because maybe part of the fun of wearing all these fly clothes or wearing all these fly sneakers was that you could go out and stunt on town with your partner, and now you don't have the ability to do so. Why bother keeping it? Do you know what I mean? Especially if you're can't even pass them out to your kids. Maybe your kids hate you. Maybe they're siding with the mom. Whatever else is going on there, it kind of puts things into perspective and kind of makes you think, you know what? I need to appreciate the things that I actually care about, and all these material possessions, you know, can kind of go away, because I'd trade all of this shit to kind of get my family back. So, you know, prayers and thoughts go out to Dante and his family and shit, probably going through a pretty tough time, you'd imagine, with everything's happening at the moment. But he did show some interesting pictures behind the scenes from, you know, going through his stuff in his storage and whatnot. He shared some never before seen pictures of Kanye West and Louis Vuitton sneaker samples from, you know, that era when Kanye did a collaboration with Louis Vuitton back in the day. We see some different colorways of the sneakers he put out. We got some cool white and black ones here, and we've also got some really nice off-white, almost like a creamy color ones that have this really nice pattern designs in the back. The funny thing about these shoes is that if they were re-released right now, I think these shoes would do fucking numbers. That's the funny thing about this design. Like, at the time when they dropped, I'd never really liked them, I'm not gonna lie. Maybe they're kind of based too much on the Margiela Futures and shit. That might be the reason why I'm not really the biggest fan of them. But I was never really the biggest fan of these shoes when they did originally release. But, you know, you could tell the timeless nature of the design, because if they did drop now, if Louis Vuitton decided to re-release these in some way, shape or form, these shoes would do absolutely numbers. And the fact that they still hold their value resale-wise tells you, you know, how well designed these were and just how much his finger was on a pulse back in the day, you know, Kanye. But it probably obviously did help that he was surrounded by such great talents like, you know, a Doncy, like a Virgil, God rest the dead and shit, and all these people kind of contributing to his kind of greatness back then, you know what I mean? So that was probably great to see. And we've also got one other picture here that features a Ye graduation era university jacket from back in the day too. So there's another kind of jacket that kind of was made and never released that Ye wore back in the day. You see him wearing some Millionaires, you see him wearing the G-Shock, you see him wearing the Jesus piece. These are all kind of iconic things that people used to wear like in the early 2000s and shit, so it's great to see that as well featured there in his kind of archives of shit. So you can only imagine all the other stuff that this guy fucking has in his fucking archive and wardrobe of things. So thoughts and prayers go out to Doncy and his family. Must be a fucking hard time, but I guess in this fucking misery someone's gonna pick up a bargain. That's the really sad thing about this whole situation. In the middle of this whole entire situation, someone's gonna pick up a fucking bargain. Can you imagine that? Can you absolutely imagine that? Can you absolutely imagine that? Anyway, moving on from that. So there was this post I wanted to this clip I wanted to quickly play for you, which I feel like is something that I've kind of been against and really kind of annoyed by in recent years. This whole trend of people doing this whole like self-loathing content, I guess in some respects it's no surprise because this resonates with a lot of people, because I think post-pandemic we're all collectively as a human race going through tough times with global recessions, with climate change, with, you know, the fucking nigh-on ever-present threat of World War III and civil wars, you know, carrying on all around the world and shit. There are things happening that are kind of negatively affecting our mental and our ability to kind of keep on keeping on, right? Cool, we understand those type of things. But I feel like there has definitely been a trend in content generation now, or in clips and shit, where people are kind of dialing into a little bit of that kind of discontent, a little bit of that ill feeling, a little bit of that, you know, uncertainty, and kind of capitalizing it. And one of it is this almost self-loathing, woe is me type of content that resonates with people because we're all going through the same thing, but doesn't really address the issue that you're talking about. And really, if anything, makes a person watching what you're putting out feel worse about the situation. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, I'm going to play the clip for you now so you completely understand what I'm saying, because I feel like this content is really fucking annoying and I wish this kind of stuff would end, but I guess people need to kind of feel like they've been seen. So that's why probably it's been doing so well.
Yeah, my mates were getting wasted at the weekend in my early 20s.
What?
They didn't drink as much as I thought. I did though. You know all those times I pawned my stuff and got a new credit card and maxed it because I had to have money to go out because all my friends were out? They weren't. I was out regularly. Most of them stayed at home regularly because they couldn't afford to do it. You know all those times I left that job because it was dead end or my manager hated me? No, they didn't. I was just inconsistent and hungover most of the time, more often than not. My friends built careers. You know all those regulars in the pub that looked like the kinds of happy that I wanted to be? They weren't really happy. They were absent fathers and husbands. I'm 36, and fear of missing out and living free ruined my life building years. I was so unhappy with myself internally, and I thought I was just saying fuck it, but I wasn't really. I was saying fuck me, and I totally fucked me. And I'm starting again 16 years on, because I've sobered up now. But I'm tired, and sometimes I'm alright with that, and I'm up to the challenge. Today's not one of those days. Yeah, my mate.
So as you can see, this guy is out here crying that, you know, he kind of spent his early days or his early parts of his kind of growing up chasing fleeting moments and not really thinking about the future. And now suddenly he's 36 and he feels like his life is over. If anything, I feel like this mindset that you have to have life figured out by the age of 36 is probably the reason why you're in a situation you're in anyway. That's the reason why, right? You think as he's talking as if he's like 86, as if he's 96. You have plenty more years ahead of you to fix whatever error or whatever mistake that you've kind of done in the past. If anything, one of the great things about learning, one of the great things about living a fucking fast life, one of the great things about indulging in all the fucking, you know, in all the things like drugs and booze and shit, is that usually, for the most part, for 90% of us, it is kind of a phase. And when that phase is over, there is usually still a lot of time left for you to kind of fix things. Unfortunately so. Life is kind of fucked up in that way. If anything, you should be kind of permanently kind of damaged, permanently scarred, and permanently kind of demoralized from trying to get back on the fucking horse and trying again. But usually those periods of your life where you're kind of going crazy, going out, doing all the stuff that you shouldn't be doing and not focusing on your career or your family or your relationships and shit and whatever it may be, you're usually a small part of your overall life, especially if you know, avoid any kind of health scares and shit. They usually don't make up the majority of your life, so you've got plenty of time to kind of, you know, rewrite those wrongs and to kind of course correct. But the idea that at some point you hit 36 and your life is over is ridiculous. And if anything, I feel like this kind of woe is me, self-loathing content is just an easy way to excuse you from doing the actual real work. It's a really weird and perverse way from excusing you from actually doing the inventory, the fucking self-work, the real brutal stripping of yourself and rebooting of yourself to actually get back to where you want to get back to, or to point you in the right direction. That's the real hard thing. The easy thing to do is to talk about your issues, is to have those issues resonate with other people because everyone else is kind of struggling and doesn't know what to do, when the actual hard thing to do is actually fix the problem. And the fixing of the problem just starts by thinking of what to do, or thinking of making the right decisions today. Make the right decisions today. Start by making one right decision, whether it's waking up, whether it's by eating a great breakfast, whether it's by fucking drinking some water and not having a soft drink, whatever it fucking is, you handle that shit and then the rest of it will usually follow. But this whole woe is me type of thing is lame. I hate it. I think it's incredibly gay. And if anything, I don't feel like this suits men. I feel like this whole self-loathing, you know, philosophical, introspective, emotional type of stuff probably suits women more so than men. Women probably could do this more because this is the type of stuff that women probably speak about within their social groups. This type of sort of thing that women probably see on their feeds in terms of the content that they kind of follow. But when it comes to men, you should be a bit more of a do-good. You should be more of a go-getter. You should be more of a doer as opposed to a talker. You should be trying to find solutions so that when you eventually do fix yourself, you can be an adequate enough mate for whoever comes around during the time that you're on your way to kind of fixing yourself. That's what you want. I would imagine, as a dude, you want to make sure that you're doing as much work as you can on yourself externally and internally, so that if somebody does come across your way who might be a mate, who might be somebody that you want to build a life with, you can be in the best position. You can be in a better position than you would have been in the past to kind of make that work. That's what you would imagine you'd want to do. Again, I could be wrong, but I think that's probably the best way to kind of go about these type of things. But I feel like these sort of videos don't really do much to sort of fixing those type of issues. Don't get me wrong. Was there a period in my life where I kind of looked at it and thought, oh my God, shit, I wasted so much time? Probably. But I think we also kind of negate, or we almost dismiss how hard it is to actually actualize your dreams, to actually figure shit out. It's not easy. People think to get where you want to get to is an overnight thing, but there very rarely are overnight successes. Most people have to work incredibly hard, have to be incredibly fortunate to actually, you know, end up with the life that they want to, you know, create for themselves. And usually it's sometimes it's outside of your control. You can sometimes do all the right things and certain things can kind of conspire against you and poof, it kind of all fucks up. Look at fucking COVID. I read so many different accounts, so many interesting accounts of people who essentially had decided to completely upend their careers, completely change where they're going to live, completely change their way of life, everything about what they were going to do. And then COVID happens and then suddenly all their plans are thrown out the window. Sometimes those things can also happen, but you have to kind of obviously figure out and work out a plan in order for you to kind of bounce back. But that also takes time. All the time it took for you to work out that plan to do so before COVID will have to be adjusted for the plan after COVID. So I think those type of things apply. But I think in general, people really do kind of, what's that word called? They really do kind of, they don't kind of keep in mind just how long life actually is, especially if you're actually aiming towards something. Now, I'm a big believer in not everybody needs to be an entrepreneur. Not everybody needs to have a company. Not everybody needs to be a hustler. Not everybody needs to be an influencer, content creator, all these sort of like hot, cool things to do out there. I think there is a lot of kind of value. There's a lot of kind of merit in just being a really good manager of a fucking bar. There's a lot of merit in being a really good employee at a fucking local cinema, at a bowling alley, working in a cafe, in a fucking pub, being a bin, like there's a really good value in just being a fucking good employee and a big work, good worker, and allowing that work to do, allowing that work to kind of help you do the things you like to do outside of work. Whether it's going on holiday, whether it's buy cool shoes, take your wife out for dinner, buy your kid shit, all that stuff's important. You just have to find a life worth living for yourself. It doesn't have to be this fancy shit. You know, like you're seeing people doing it online, has to be a life worth living for you. Now, it just means it sometimes takes time. For instance, if you want to be a store manager at a retail store, you have to start somewhere. You have to either start as a sales assistant on the weekends, full time, as a supervisor, maybe in the back room, maybe as a fucking janitor. You have to start somewhere. And then eventually, if you want to head to the point of being a general manager, an area manager, or whatever it may be, that is something that you could also kind of aim for. But you have to start somewhere. And I feel like a lot of people kind of underestimate that start and underestimate how long that journey can take. But in my personal opinion, again, my personal opinion, I feel like that journey is the greatest part of the whole thing. I feel like sometimes getting there probably is the hardest thing to kind of wrangle to get your head around. I remember when I worked my first real good job where I was kind of getting like, you know, 40 grand a year and shit, right? When I was like, oh shit. I was like mid-20s, I was thinking, shit, man, I'm making some actual real good money. Especially back then I was living at home and shit, right? So that was all money that was going straight into my account. I was thinking, fuck, man. But I also remember feeling a little bit empty because I realized, oh shit, I actually don't want a really good high paying job. All that time I thought I did. All that time I remember I was sort of like looking at people like Heron Preston when he was working at Nike and being the head of energy marketing. I was looking at A-Side when he was at energy marketing at Nike. I was looking at all these cool people that had all these cool industry jobs, and I was thinking that's what I wanted. But then when I kind of got my own cool industry job, again, it wasn't in Nike or whatever. I was like working at Masters, doing that course thing that I was doing, where it was really cool because it allowed me to kind of, you know, see and communicate a lot of my heroes. Obviously, I got a chance to work with Virgil back then. But when I was doing that job and I was making like the 40K I was making at that time, I realized quite soon, I was like, oh shit, I actually don't want this. I thought I did, but I didn't. But I have to be honest, that journey to get there was way more beneficial than the actual getting of the salary, because the salary kind of made me feel a bit empty. The job itself didn't really fulfill me, but the journey to get there was what made it worth it, right? Doing all the long nights, all the presentations I did, flying across the country, around the world, meeting all these cool, interesting people, that was what made it worthwhile. But then when I finally got there, I realized, you know what, actually, I want to work for myself, I want to do my own thing, and that's kind of where I kind of see my kind of fulfillment and my purpose kind of coming from. But everybody's kind of different. But I honestly do think savoring the journey, enjoying the process is really beneficial, because sometimes, again, you might get there, you might not like it. You might start off being a weekend staff member. You're not making that much money. You're making minimum wage per hour, but then you end up getting the big job of being the area manager. You're the key holder. And now suddenly, guess what? You don't have time to pick up your kids. You don't have time to have dinner with your wife as much as often as you please. You don't have time to watch the football as much as you did before in the past. You don't have time to play video games. All these things can sometimes suffer by the wayside. So you have to kind of, you know, it's a bit of a balancing act to figure out what kind of works for you. But sometimes you have to be careful what you wish for. But I also feel like the journey is worth it. It's worth that kind of risk of figuring out, oh shit, it's not what I want. But there's always plenty of time, especially if you figure it out that you're going in the wrong direction. And I feel like to stand there at 36 years of age and think your life is over because you're not where your friends are is a nonsense, because your friends were probably working on their careers when you were all like drinking, or when you thought you were all drinking together. They were working on their careers 10 years ago. So it's only natural that now at 36, they're also coming into their own, and they're also kind of achieving their goals and suddenly achieving all their dreams, because they've been working on it for 10 plus years. So why should you expect if you haven't been doing anything, that suddenly it's going to work out for you in 10 plus years. That makes no sense. So I feel like this kind of content is a bit nutty. It's a bit dumb. I don't feel like it does anything to really advance or further the conversation. If anything, I feel like it just kind of makes people feel like it's almost like it makes you feel like you're doing something because you're complaining, if that makes any sense. There's probably a quote about self-loathing and how it kind of helps you feel better about situation, because you can't really, sometimes it's hard to kind of pinpoint people on the outside who are affecting you or hurting you. So you maybe kind of point at yourself, right? Or you maybe try and be extra hard on yourself as a way to kind of like punish yourself and to make yourself feel bad. And then you hope that can kind of spurn you on. Doesn't really do much. If anything, I feel like the best way to go about things is to identify, hey, I am going off course, then course correct, and then do the necessary things to get you back to where you want to get to. Little kind of micro wins every single day to kind of get there. Again, I could be incorrect in this sort of stuff. I could be wrong. But I think I kind of know what I'm talking about when it comes to that stuff. I kind of do. I know what I'm talking about. Continuing on with this one, we got this clip. This clip is taken from a newly released episode, courtesy of the guys from Figmunity World. So those are all the dudes who kind of left No Jumper. They're associated with Back on Fig. They're associated with Community. They're associated with Ace Boys. And this is a new show called What Could Go Wrong that features Pun, that features Keem, and that features T-Rell. In this particular clip, it's off of the back of T-Roll basically commenting on his ongoing beef with his brother called Big Deal and all the friction that's been caused with their on-air dispute that then spilled over to No Jumper because Big Deal went and did an episode with No Jumper. But on this side of the conversation, they almost start talking about podcasting and the issues that they've all had. And part of the kind of background I'm going to give you is that one of the shows associated with Ace Boys, with Figmunity World, with Community called Apollo, the guy that kind of runs it called MacWop has been coming into a bit of criticism from the fans and from Flacco as well, because he doesn't pay his co-host. So he does his podcast on his own channel, and I guess he gets his friends to come around his house and record a podcast that does really well called The Apollo, and it gets really good numbers in terms of live streams and even the clips and shit, and they have a lot of legendary funny moments. But it's now being, you know, brought to everybody's attention that the co-hosts don't get paid, and I for one can't figure out why these guys think it's perfectly okay to have a stream, a podcast show with your friends as co-host who kind of contribute to the show's success, and you don't even pay them a monetary fee, you know, even just like a fee, just to kind of, you know, as a gesture of your kind of appreciation, like $100. And it's never kind of come into their thinking. For some reason, it doesn't. Anyway, Keem, Pun, and T-Roll basically talk and debate amongst themselves as to the pros and cons of paying your friends. And I'm going to comment on it on the other side. So let's play this clip and let's hear what you guys have to say as well as you tune in.
I'm going to make my left and I'm going to keep going.
This shit is a high right now for a lot of motherfuckers, man. Like, and they chasing this high, bro. They coming around. Nobody was ever like praising these niggas or, oh, you're cool. Oh, you're funny. Like, and you're hearing hundreds of people hit you and say that. It's a high, bro. It's like, hold on. Shit, yesterday I was just over here trying to figure out, nigga, why nobody be calling me on my phone. Now today I got hundreds of people in my DM saying they love me. I should start my own channel. This, that. So it becomes a high. And now it's like, I want more of that shit. So now it's like, hey, what you doing? I'm going to pull up on your show. I'm going to pull up on your show. Then here comes the narratives. Nobody's being paid. Damn.
Nobody loves
paid.
Me.
Like, why should we pay you? Certain motherfuckers make sense.
People get paid for that job. No, that's why they saying that. They just don't know the business.
This ain't your job, nigga. You pulling up. You're calling the ass to come up here. We're not calling you. That's the difference.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
A job is when, hey, nigga, I need you today for 2 hours, nigga. Hey, be on this pod. That's a job. But for niggas who just like, hey, where y'all at? Nigga, me and Smack about to do our show. Okay, I pull up.
It's also a thing of how, I'm just giving perspective of, if I feel like I play good and they do get paid for this right here, what I do, and I think I'm good, like, all right, cool. Call me, yo, is it a way I can get paid to do this since there's a line to get paid?
Hey, can you go to a Laker game and tell motherfucking Jenny Buss that you want to be paid just because you showed up to the game and they didn't ask you to come?
No, but if you suited up on that squad and performed in front of...
when you come sit down at anything,
you're not suited up.
That is suited up.
That's the perception. That's where people fuck up.
No, that's no.
You're not suited up, bro.
You are suiting up when you come sit down on the
no, partners. Nigga.
It don't matter what
you're
it is.
Not, you're suiting up if I say, "Hey, I need you today." Here, put this on.
No, whether I need you or not, I'm saying if I come sit down, we're something to be done right here, right? We're about to do it. So now, once they get press record until that motherfucker press stop, I just played in that game like it was with the Lakers.
Nigga, no, listen.
I wasn't in the practice squad. I played in the game with
listen.
Y'all.
Listen,
you playing at the YMCA, bitch.
So that means you're at the YMCA.
There's certain players that are needed in order to perform and give a great game. Certain players aren't needed. Meaning, you're not a part of the team. You're, cool, you're a homie. Yeah. You could pull up, sit down, but right here, back on field, it's Matt, Heather, T-Rip, Macwa. Anybody else that pull up, nigga, hold on. When it's time for tryouts to make the team, then you can feel like you're a part of the team.
No,
but you
can't just come sit down. I don't agree with
two
that.
Two times.
I get that, for sure.
You can't come sit down two, three times and
we're
feel
saying
like,
the same shit.
Now they owe me a check.
So, I generally don't agree with this, and I feel like Keem isn't really fighting his point that well. But essentially, Pun is being incredibly facetious and trying to misrepresent the argument. The argument that play when this first started, this debate, was to do with Apollo. Apollo is hosted by MacWop, includes Tiny, includes Keem, and a few other characters. But there's like three other characters apart from MacWop that are involved in making Apollo a success. MacWop's channel has been about forever. He's had his channel probably as long as I've had my channel, right? As a YouTube channel, he's had long-standing. He's done vlogs on it, you know, documenting his journey, content, DJing, whatever, right? He's done all that shit on there. But nothing has popped off the way the Apollo show has popped off on his channel. And that is in large part because of himself and obviously the cast of characters that are on that show. And the channel or the videos for Apollo generate probably anywhere between like 30K plus views per live stream, not including whatever donations they get per stream. Why is it beyond reason to suggest or to think that the co-host of that show who are responsible for who partly responsible for the views that show gets shouldn't be entitled to even a month, even like a measly fee, like $100 per episode? What's so bad about that? That's just a gesture to kind of demonstrate their contribution to the show's success and to obviously compensate them for their time. I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. Just paying these guys in weed and drinks is not good enough. And I feel like if they're your friends, it definitely isn't a great way to reward them, isn't a great way to acknowledge their contribution. If anything, it kind of makes it seem like you think you're the reason why the channel is where it's at, you're the reason why it's successful, or that somehow you deserve all the money, even though you're doing a show with other people who are also contributing to the success of it. It makes no sense. And the really sad thing about this for me is this. I've always thought of, again, this is really, you know, this is a little bit lame to say, but I've always thought that podcasting for black people is like the Industrial Revolution. Or for people from ends, forget black people. For people that grew up from the hood, people that grew up in poverty, podcasting and content creation is like the Industrial Revolution for us. It's given us the ability to monetize our pain, our suffering, our dysfunction. It's made us possible to kind of capitalize on maybe some of our inherent traits of being charismatic, of being funny, of being good on camera, whatever it may be, right? We can somehow profit from this shit, right? And it's probably made way more thousandaires and millionaires than anything else in modern times, I'd imagine, for a whole swath of people who didn't really have an option to kind of, you know, make that sort of money, especially if you're working in the entertainment industry. You're not a rapper, you're maybe not a journalist and shit. How else are you going to try and get involved in the culture and try and kind of play your part? Now, podcasting, content creation, and live streaming has allowed people like myself or people that are from the hood, who are from ends, who are from low income circumstances to kind of, you know, traverse up that kind of socioeconomic ladder and essentially put themselves on, support their family, feed themselves, feed their friends, blah, blah, blah. I would imagine because the industry is so new, because it's so green, because it's almost so unregulated, you can make up the rules yourself. You can define the industry standards. You can dictate what the terms are. You can basically set in stone what the good practices are. And I would assume as well, because a lot of these people are coming from the music industry, right? Who kind of maybe associated with labels, maybe associated with radio stations, with magazines. You would imagine all the fuck shit you've seen in the music industry, you're going to make sure that you're not going to try to repeat in the podcasting industry. But if anything, they're doing the same thing. They're doing exactly the same bad practices, the exact same bad habits that made the music industry the cesspool of, you know, nonsense and scamming that it is now into the podcast industry. And it's disgusting because I feel like nowadays, if you have a channel, and again, MacWap's channel, not to kind of pocket watch people, but most likely based on AdSense alone, that guy's channel is probably generating anywhere between like, I don't know, 5K to 20K per month. Is it really that much to be breaking off your friends $100 per month? So $100 per episode. Maybe that equals up to $500 per person per month. Is that really that much to kind of break off to your friends to make sure that they know that they're appreciated and to obviously to be like a demonstration of their, you know, of your appreciation of their input and how they've been contributing to the system of the channel? Is that really that much to ask for? And what that ends up doing, it ends up building good practices so that when you end up blowing up and growing and become even bigger than what you are, and then you get a $100,000 check, you get $1 million check, you get tens of million dollar check, it then becomes easier to break that down. But if you can't break down a grand, if you can't bust down 10 grand with your boys, how are you going to bust down $1 million? It's impossible. So if these guys aren't getting paid now, I most likely don't think they're ever going to get paid ever. And it really does make you think, it really does boggle the mind, because it makes you think to yourself, like, why do they think their friends who co-host a show aren't deserving of the money? What Pun was saying was true. Some of the other guys who just join in just to kind of hang out and vibe, of course, they probably don't need to get paid, right? But if you are requesting somebody to come on your show as a sort of gig, as a job, they deserve a bit of payment for that. I would assume if that was me and I had a channel and I had a podcast that was doing crazy numbers and I had a co-host or somebody that came on here regularly, I would pay them in the same way that how I remember somebody saying that about Ari Shaffir. When Ari Shaffir was doing his podcast, and I think other comedians probably do it but don't talk about it, but Ari Shaffir was known to give his guests like I think $100 or something, right? And I think some person, I forgot what comedian it was, but I think it might have been, some comedian was like, that $100 that Ari Shaffir gave him that time actually saved him for that month because he had absolutely no money. He had no idea where he was going to get the money from. And then Ari Shaffir asked him to be in his podcast and then boom, he's got $100 and that legitimately held him down. So that, what you think is a measly payment can sometimes go a long way to helping people out. And it's just a great way to kind of show your friends that you respect and honor them. I feel like for me, maybe because I come from the school of thinking where you should always pay your friends. But I've been a big believer that if you have a friend that's a graphic designer, if you have a friend that's a fucking voice actor, if you have a friend that's a carpenter, if you have a friend that owns a van, pay them. Don't give them beer. Don't take them out for lunch, all that nonsense. No, give them money. It might not be their fucking market rate or whatever, or the industry rate, but give them money as a symbolism of like, hey, I respect your time. I know usually you we do other shit and you're helping me out as a friend. Here's $50. Here's $100. Like, pay your fucking friends. And I feel like that actually goes a long way to solidifying the friendship and absolutely taking it to a next level. But if you're in a position now where you're not paying your friends for these podcast things, when it's clear, especially on the MacWap side of things, it's clear. If you go on the channel, you can clearly see Apollo, especially the ones where all the co-hosts are on there, plus all the extra friends, the numbers they do vis-a-vis his own shit that also does fairly well, but not as well as the other stuff. It's clear to see that his friends are contributing to the success of the podcast, which is obviously in turn contributing to the success of the channel. And now his channel's got to a point where the pod is doing so good, or the live stream is doing so well, it's now having an effect on his own live stream that he does when he goes traveling and shit. Now those vlogs are starting to get more views than they used to in the past because everybody's now interested in MacWap because of his personality that he has when he's doing on Apollo. So I personally think it's really disappointing to see these guys not able to somehow rewrite the wrongs of the music industry and to also make their own rules for this new industry. And basically create industry standards, create put things in place that would ensure that they can kind of dictate the terms in this new space and also make sure that everybody around them eats. It's not really that difficult to say, because Pun is being facetious on purpose by saying that, oh, if you're on the LA Lakers and you don't play, do you? It's like, bro, everybody on the team in the squad gets money. They all don't get LeBron James money, but if you're signed to the Lakers, you get fucking paid. That's part of the, that's what we were saying. Like, all these guys are on the version of the Lakers, especially Keem and Tiny and shit. They're on the fucking Apollo. They should get paid. Maybe they shouldn't get paid as much as fucking MacWalk, because it's his channel, it's his house, it's his studio, his equipment, his mics. We know that. That's common sense. But they should be getting some level of a fee, some level of a payment, just to demonstrate their contribution to the overall success of the show. And the fact that they don't, and the fact that it's even a discussion or an argument or a debate, says a lot about where we are as people, as black people in general. Because I was watching this other video the other day, actually. Funnily enough, it was titled, Why is Africa So Poor? And I think the thumbnail description was like, it's not what you expect. And actually, the video was what you expect. It was corruption, it was greed, all that sort of shit, right? And it's the stuff that my dad used to talk to me about all the time when I was younger. And it's really depressing, because, you know, you think of all the natural resources that are in Africa, all the natural minerals and shit that are used in smartphones, all this other stuff, and, you know, electronic fucking EVs and shit, right? EV cars and shit. And Africa is still as poor as it is at the moment. And most of it is because of us. Just us kind of scumming each other, us scumming one another, us scumming colleagues, just to kind of line our own pockets, as opposed to looking at the bigger picture. Like, why don't most streets in fucking Africa, why aren't there pavements? You know what I mean? Why aren't there fucking sewage systems? Why aren't people living in actual, you know, decent enough level housing? Why isn't some electricity in some places? Because somebody would much rather line their own pockets, would much rather ensure their kid goes to a private school, would much rather drive an expensive car than to have the ability to have all their people be somewhat, you know, living on the good terms. And that's something I've always kind of hated. And I think, unfortunately, we're seeing it play out in this new kind of podcast content creation space, because some of these guys are just like, they're so, I wouldn't say even stubborn or greedy. I'm not sure what it is, or tight-fisted, but this idea that you make a show with other people, they contribute to the success of it, even though you're maybe the Beyonce of the group, but they don't deserve any payment, is insane. Like, we all know there's going to be a star of the show or a leader or somebody that takes it. But the fact that you can't fucking recognize other people's contribution and just, and again, I'm not saying that you deserve $1,000 a month. Maybe they do. But $100 as a kind of, you know, as a demonstration of your appreciation shouldn't really be that much to kind of break off. But, you know, I guess when it comes to these kind of content creation space things, when that money hits your account, it's maybe a bit harder to kind of break off people, because you probably never had that money hit your account in the first place, right? Those type of funds are probably hard to kind of get your head around. But I really do wish there was a little bit more of that collective thinking, these type of things. But, you know, probably isn't going to happen anytime soon. But I thought that was really disappointing to see. I thought that was really, really, really disappointing to see. But what can you do? What can you do? Moving on. So, I quickly want to talk about Shogun. I'm sure I've spoken about it plenty of times on here before. I'm going to keep talking about it because I'm a big history buff. I'm a big fan of period pieces. I'm a big fan of TV series in general, especially ones that are just almost self-indulgent, almost don't really speak to the current times we're in now, and just do a really good job in terms of nailing all the unnecessary details. But Shogun is absolutely fantastic. Maybe one of the best TV series I've watched in recent years. Maybe even better than Vikings. I'm not going to lie. This might even surpass Vikings, even though I think this is only like a one season miniseries and Vikings went on for several seasons. I think Shogun does a far better job of depicting that era of Japan, that era in time of Japan and the history around it, than maybe Vikings did. The detail around it, the production, everything about the story is absolutely incredible. The only thing that I don't really like about Shogun now, having watched it 5 episodes in now, the latest episode came out the other day, might be the white actor. The role of this white actor in this character, the character in this show, the English dude in Shogun, he might be the most insufferable character in the whole thing. Because I guess part of the lore of Shogun, a part of the story, is that there's this tension between the East and the West, right? There's this tension between the New World and the Old World, between Eastern society, Western society. But it seems like he just never gets it. He never understands just how different the traditions and the practices and the lives of people who live in Japan at that sort of era are to where he's come from. And now we're 5 episodes in and he's still butting his head against just how different, weird, peculiar, and just completely alien to his life these guys are, and vice versa. Because I feel like sometimes there are instances in Shogun where the differences between both societies are amazing. They kind of help, right? They really help to kind of tell the story. It's almost like there's a quiet respect between, oh, we live our ways. This, we live, our lives are about, like, it's, for instance, the West is about individuality, right? And the East is about collectivism, right? About doing what's best for the tribe, the people, your family, right? It's less about thinking of yourself and more so about thinking about the collective good. And I feel like sometimes the respect and the, you know, acknowledgement of that sometimes make the show beautiful, because it's like, okay, cool. We don't agree, but we sort of kind of head nod in the fact that how we both live our lives completely differently, but we can understand why we choose to live our lives this way. But in this show so far, episode 5, it seems that this character just has no idea, no concept to understand why they don't want to change the way that they live just because he feels like his way of living is different or is better. He just can't fucking figure it out. It's fucking annoying. And it's starting to do my nothing. Like, he might be the most insufferable character. I think maybe he's done a little, maybe he's a little bit, he's done a bit too heavy handed. Maybe the actor himself is a little bit annoying him just as a person. I'm not really sure. But I feel like the white actor in this show is fucking infuriating. And the fucking Anjin. But apart from that, as a show, I think it's absolutely sublime. I think the cinematography, the direction, the pacing, the fact that it's 90% in fucking Japanese, all subtitles, there's no fucking English conversation. Like, I love that there's a proper language barrier between the both. Things get lost in translation all the time. That fucking adds to the confusion and to the errors and mistakes, and sometimes it becomes lethal. I love it. I fucking love it. I recommend you check it out, Shogun, and find it where, you know, you watch TV series. I think it might be available on like FX or something, but you know, I get my stuff out usually you know, on not so legit areas. But definitely recommend you check it out. Shogun's absolutely brilliant. Loved everything about it. Really fucking did enjoy it. I really do encourage you to check it out. Shogun is absolutely sublime, one of my most favorite series, and I do hope that you check it out. I really, 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 really do. Anyway, that has been the Agostino Zynga Show, episode number 754. 754 of the Agostino Zynga Show. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you've enjoyed it. Hope you've liked it. If you have, please make sure you leave me a 5-star review on the Apple Podcast platform or the Spotify platform or whatever platform you're listening to this podcast. Please make sure you leave me a 5-star review. That would be so much appreciated. You don't have to do it, but if you did do it, I'd be so eternally grateful. For those of you watching via the live stream, please make sure that you smash the like button down below. That will also be appreciated. Smash that like button down below. That will also be appreciated. That will also be appreciated. Links to me and everything that I do can be found in the description too. You find links to my DJ sets at soundcloud.com/handsomeblackman. You'll find that all in the description. Links to my websites, my social media can be found in the description also. Check that out if you do so, please. And of course, if you want to contact me via email, make sure you check out my main website where all my podcast is, and you can click the contact button and you can email me over there. The link to it is theagostinozyngashow.com. It's theagostinozyngashow.com. I'll put a link to that in the fucking chat if you want to check it out. It's down below. Check that out as well. There we go. Click the contact button. As you can see here on the screen, all you got to do is click the contact button here and you can send me an email if you have anything to talk about regarding the show itself. And I'll be on hand to discuss anything with you ASAP, ASAP, ASAP. Of course, if you're listening to the audio side of the show, you should hear my tune of the day. My tune of the day has to be none other than fucking Fisher. I'm sure most of you have heard this tune. There's a viral fucking dance going around that everybody's doing, that I'm currently doing. It's made by Cash Cobain and Basswag. It's called Fisher. That's my tune of the day. It's going to be playing in the background for those of you listening. If you're not listening, you won't be hearing it. It'll fade to black. But for now, take care, my friends. It's been a pleasure. Pleasure to have your company. And I'll see all you guys again very, 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 very soon. Take care. Be safe. Peace. Sucking different, and she tatted too. And she independent, swear this bitch is different, and she nasty too. Yeah, my body different when I'm over here, I'm an animal. And her body different, I'ma eat on that bitch like I'm Hannibal. I'ma add the food, I get active too. I'ma eat that pussy like an edible. For sure. I'ma from Percocet, but no mommy be popping that Adderall. For sure. That pussy be purple wet when you win it, it feel like it's grabbing you. For sure. Mad at you, but I had to do what I had to do. For sure. She got an attitude when she suddenly niggas like she mad at you. For sure. I want y'all to go back, just like end this beef from Cash, not from YouTube.
Yep,
that's me. Match it. Cash, not from YouTube. Thunder chill like NBA, what I thought a nigga was from Baton Rouge. Made a sign of NBA, fuck what niggas say, we don't follow rules. Put that pussy on my face, get your pussy drained like some Mountain Dew. In my we out with Lou, we found something new, had to find them blue. They ain't giving mouth like you, make it pass like you, make it pass like you. If I need to hit you up, just take it or not, I can count on you. Lately I've been sipping drinks, pushing hella states, I ain't in the mood. Sliding in the Bentley truck with a Spanish bitch, put in some mood. For sure. For sure. She blowin' it like it was a flu. For sure. Pussy so good, I'm never dumbing you. For sure. We met at the Ritz Carlton, not the W. For sure. I mix the honey and Henny, I'm tryna have fun with you. For sure. Attitude, what you better say, so I ain't mad at you. And you tell it to what I gotta do to be having you. I feel the avenue, top 560 in a savage too. And your ass fat, know you eat your rice and your cabbage too. She a savage too, I'm a savage too, it's compatible. She was talking practice, had to cut her off, got a battle boo. I ain't chicken tender, if you find my brother, I ain't mad at you. Fucking in the kitchen, we ain't even make it to the master room. Met her in the trenches, when she suckin' different, and she tatted too.